Steve, thanks so much. Hi, everybody. It's me, Bill. I'm going to have to ask everybody's help on something. And I want to be quiet about this because I don't know that I need the bosses to hear this. Wendy is not here.
What?
Wendy is not here right now. Now, she's scheduled to come in later for the second half of the show. Steve does the Wintrust business lunch from 12 to 1, and Wendy is scheduled to come in and do the show from 1 to 3, but she's not here now. The problem is this. We're only given certain amount of days off, personal days, through the year, and it's only February, and Wendy hasn't used up a lot of them, but she can't afford at this point to give up a half day. So, if it's okay with you, from time to time, we'll just address her and pretend that she's being really quiet today.
Sort of stewing or something like
that? Yeah, maybe something was said that she didn't agree with.
Fuming?
Yeah, maybe.
In deep thought, perhaps?
That kind of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, if you call in at any point during the show or text in, 312-981-7200, just, you know, for the sake of if the bosses are listening, just say something like, well, it was like Wendy was saying earlier, or I agree with Wendy when she said that thing a little while ago. That sort of thing. I don't want her to lose a day off. She can't afford it. So she's here, as far as you know. She's just being quiet. Right, Wendy? Exactly. All right. Steve, Wendy and I were just talking about something, and maybe you can help us out.
Yeah.
Donald Trump is alleging now that he's got some dirt on the Ricketts family.
I saw that. I know. I thought you guys would want to talk about that.
Let's discuss that for just a little bit. The Ricketts family, as you know, owns your Chicago Cubs, and they made their money in the tech world. The Ricketts family did very, very well with Ameritrade, and I know they had some smaller properties as well, but their bread and butter is Ameritrade. They've done extremely well. And Ma and Pa Ricketts are fairly political. Is that safe to say?
Very political, yeah. Very conservative political, yeah.
All right, so we found out over the weekend that Ma and Pa Ricketts, the owner of the Cubs' parents, have invested fairly heavily in negative ads about Donald Trump, right? I'm getting that right?
Yeah, there was something weird in Iowa. I remember talking to people where, and Wendy can back me up on this, but where
she is nodding for the record.
Is she?
Yep.
I think that they actually bought ads for Sanders or something like that with the idea that it would weaken Hillary Clinton. A lot of weird things going on.
Yeah. So now Donald Trump gets wind of this, as he's apt to do. He finds out that the Ricketts family is involved in spending a lot of money, millions and millions of dollars, to make him look badly. And, you know, Donald Trump has a way about him. If somebody does or says something negative, he handles it very diplomatically, right? Here's the tweet that came from Donald Trump earlier today. I hear the Ricketts family, who own the Chicago Cubs, are secretly spending dollars against me. They better be careful. They have a lot to hide. All right, so here's the question, and Steve, you may know the answer to this, and maybe you don't. Wendy, you may also know the answer to this, and maybe you don't. Donald Trump speaks in these incredible generalities. Is it possible that they've got something dangerous to hide, or is that just one of those things that he does from time to time to say, there might be something there, there might not be something there, but I'm going to play the card anyway?
I'm going to say he's just playing the card.
He's bluffing.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. But isn't this, at the heart of politics, this is the way the game is played in terms of spending money to make your opponents look bad? He's done it. He's going to continue to do it. Are people not allowed to do it to him?
Well, can I just say, too, that the Ricketts people bought ads in favor of Bernie Sanders in Iowa?
Right.
Which I'm sure I still don't quite understand. But no, you know, Donald Trump, when Ted Cruz was running spots featuring Donald Trump on Meet the Press,
right,
video of Donald Trump saying things about his pro-life stance,
right,
he threatened to sue for defamation over that. So
this does just get better and better and better.
It wasn't even, I didn't say that because we watched him say it, but he said, I don't believe that anymore.
He's also now alluding to the fact, you know, he's been against Ted Cruz because, as you all know, Ted Cruz was born in Canada. So Donald Trump says that Cruz should not be able to run for the Oval Office because he was born outside of the country. But now he's also taking a harder stance on Marco Rubio, saying technically he really should not be able to run for president because his parents are both of Cuban extraction. So that is also a violation.
I didn't hear that part.
So, yeah, that was over the weekend, too. So now any of the front runners, with the exception, of course, of him, although if I were Trump, I would also question his own ability to run because he's married to a woman from another country. But Trump isn't taking that route.
He hasn't gone that way.
No,
yet. No,
not yet. Not yet. So it does get better and better. Were you surprised at all about Jeb Bush's announcement over the weekend that his campaign is now also, quote-unquote, suspended?
A little bit, not overall. I mean, I was watching it when he started, and as soon as he started speaking, in fact, Lindsey Graham, the way he thanked him for his work, I'm like, uh-oh, he's dropping
out.
Yeah. And, you know, they said if he didn't do well in South Carolina, he probably would. I didn't think he would do it Saturday night.
All right, we've discussed this before, and Wendy is nodding her head in agreement. We have discussed this before. This was a guy that everybody said before he entered the race, well, this is the guy. This is the golden boy of the Republican Party.
Right.
Why was there never a moment from the time he announced his candidacy till over the weekend when he suspended it, there was never a time where he even came close? What did he do wrong?
I think he was at the wrong time, and I think Donald Trump, you know, just sucked all the oxygen out. Trump defined him early as being low energy.
Yeah.
If you watch that very first debate, you know, I mean, if you watched it with the idea that it was Jeb Bush feeling like he woke up on a Saturday Night Live skit, because that's kind of the way it looked.
Dazed,
you know?
And confused.
Yeah, he never fit in the room with all the other rascals, and it just, you know, it just didn't fit. It wasn't the time.
But all that supposed support for him that was supposed to be there, and it's everybody saying, oh, if and when Jeb Bush enters this election, then we've got something. It just never materialized.
Well, it did materialize in the form of big money. So you had the establishment people, the money people behind him in a big way. It did not materialize when it comes to voters. And it's just, you know, the voters are just ticked off. I mean, you know, they're supporting Donald Trump.
Yeah.
In ways, you know, he won with evangelicals. He's hardly an evangelical.
Yeah.
He won with the military in South Carolina when he was talking, you know, sort of blaming George Bush for the September 11th attacks, which is verboten for a Republican candidate to do.
I know.
So all these things that you think people would vote by, they're not. They're just kind of voting because they're mad as hell and they're looking for the outside guy.
He pulled out the thing about how Bush blatantly lied about the weapons of mass destruction.
Right, right.
And I went, oh, is this one of those moments where, although I thought the Pope thing was that, I thought the John McCain thing was that, every time he pulls one of these out, I go, this could be the one, but they never are.
Yeah, look, he called a heroic prisoner of war a loser because he got caught, and he still won overwhelmingly among the military voters in South Carolina. So they're not voting. They're not. People aren't voting by tradition this time.
It's the strangest thing. It really is. Another observation about the political race that I made over the weekend, and I want to share it with you in just a little bit. Stay where you are. If you do want to jump in, 312-981-7200. It's us. It's Bill and Wendy together on WGN. It's us. It's Bill Leff. And, of course, I'll do it. Wendy Snyder. Wendy, by the way, you're getting a lot of texts, people watching us on the stream, and they love your outfit. Everybody's very happy with the outfit you're wearing today. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. You can call us there or you can text us there. We're talking about another very, very unlikely weekend in the political race. Let's start out with Sally. Sally, how are things? Everything good?
Yeah, except for the horrifying fear that Donald Trump might get in.
Now, what is it about Donald Trump being president that scares you?
Because I think he's a despicable human being, as, you know, as a person. He takes no responsibility for the things that he says. I think he's egged on by the American people because they can't get rid of him no matter what horrifying thing he says or what group he insults. They're still voting for him, and it's just because the world is fed up with, you know, the status quo, which I am too. But I would rather elect you as president, much rather elect you as president, than put a man in that has nothing but shock value to give people.
He uses
bankruptcy as a tool, not a last resort, when people are fighting for their lives not to file bankruptcy. They're fighting to do the right thing instead of just saying, well, you know, whatever, let somebody else pay for it. You know, that's how we get into this trouble. He is just despicable. He turns my stomach.
But Sally,
I will not even
I keep hearing this. I hear this day in and day out, people with the same exact opinion that you just expressed. And yet, for some reason, and no one can explain it, his numbers just keep going up and up and up. More and more people are buying them all the time. I don't get it either.
Well, I think it's just because we're so disgusted with the way things are run by our current government that the government is too intrusive and too big and too everything. And, you know, if we had one run presidents from dog catcher on up to the president, one term and get out and put somebody else, these career politicians who are just lining their own pockets, in my opinion, and really doing nothing for you or I, is the problem. And to put a knucklehead like this in charge of everybody, can you see it? He goes and hangs out with Vladimir Putin or any of these other, you know, Kim Jong-un. Yeah, you're really a great guy. They really love me over there. You know, oh, my God, I'm just so horrified over the possibility that this Nimrod might actually get in there.
See, the last Sally, it's the last part that you just said that scares me the most, is that he lacks tact. And you think about the diplomacy that's necessary to be the president. And when he's in there with those very, very other, very powerful other world leaders and says or does the wrong thing, what's going to happen
Precisely.
Then? I know.
Precisely. And that's where we're screwed. We're so completely screwed. If people don't wake up and realize what they're voting for and realize that, okay, yeah, we don't want what we've had, but my God, we don't want this either. It's a cartoon character leading our country. I have to move to Switzerland. I have to go.
I'll go with you.
I have to go, and I will miss you terribly.
Listen to the podcast. They're in Switzerland. Sally, thank you. Okay. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Now, a text just said this. Hello, Bill and Wendy, in brackets. I'm not sure why that's in brackets. He takes total responsibility for what he says. He states the truth. I'm not positive he I'm not sure any politician states the truth. It's always kind of their version of the truth. So depending on what your truth is, maybe they do and maybe they don't. I do hear some truths coming from them, but there's a lot more non-truths than truths. Where's Robert? Hold on a second. Hey, Robert, it's us. It's Bill and Wendy. Hi.
Hi. I love your show, by the way.
Thank you, sir.
Great show.
Thank you.
But Mr. Trump, yeah, I'm mystified too. And what scares me is it says something about America that this guy continues to be on top. Although he's getting 30-35% of the vote, but that means that they're like 60-65% of the people that aren't voting for him.
True.
And he's presuming that if the other candidates were not in the running, those votes would come over to him. No, they won't come over to him because if people who wanted to vote for him would have voted for him in the first place. Now, what scares me is what kind of a world leader can you imagine? He cannot take criticism.
Right.
He hates to lose. When he lost in Iowa, remember, we didn't hear from him for a couple of days. It was kind of refreshing. His silly tweets in the morning weren't there.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden he pops up blaming Cruz for stealing the election.
True.
And he continues to say to this day that he actually won, but Cruz stole it. And so, but if you analyze, how could Cruz have stolen it? Now, we know what happened. Carson decided to go down, and Cruz allegedly told people, look, he's out of the race, so vote for me.
It wasn't allegedly. He did.
He definitely did.
I mean,
he sent out pamphlets that said that, right, Steve? Is that what went on?
I think he had his
mailers.
There's a robocall to his captains, and so they spread the word.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, but he beat Trump by over 2,000 votes, which means that in a relatively short period of time, 24 hours, when Carson announced he was going to go to Florida, he would have had to mobilize ground troops, robocalls, and robo emails, insisting that they were asking people to vote for him because Carson was out of the race.
Yeah.
But once again, that presumes that all those people, more than 2,000, would happily vote for Trump. They would have voted for him in the first place if they really cared about him.
Robert,
what also scares me.
Oh, go on.
The,
right.
The white supremacists are. I saw the man on one of the heads of white supremacist group on CNN, and
that's CNN, okay. Sure, you're fine.
Yeah, you know that they are sending roll calls and emails out by the thousands, telling people Trump is our man.
Yeah.
Now, Trump did not ask for their endorsement.
Yeah.
I'm sure the last thing in the world he wants is that, but it shows that they see something in him.
I know.
That, you know, and what if he gets angry at a meeting of world leaders?
Yeah.
He doesn't like something that they're doing. Is he going to just pout and go home?
That seems to be his way. Yeah.
Now, he never gives his plan. I wish a reporter or somebody, Anderson Cooper, did back him up the other night. because somebody from the audience asked him, did you at one time support the going into Iraq? He has continued to say, no, no, no. Well, they played the clip where
with him and Howard Stern.
On, he did, and, but he wouldn't admit to that.
Right.
And Cooper, he tried to get off on a sidetrack. Cooper wouldn't let him. He kept saying, so did you or did you not support the war? And he kind of meekly said, well, I guess I might have. Did you or did you not call President Bush a liar for getting us into the war on the supposed heavy armaments? And he again, he refused to answer until Cooper finally said, so did you or did you not? And
yep.
Once again, Trump sheepishly said, well, I guess I could have. See, if you back him up and getting rid of the ISIS. Now, look, we'd all like to get rid of ISIS.
Yeah.
What is planned? It's online on Wikipedia. And bomb the hell out of him. Well, okay, that hey, I'm all for that. But he says you can't. You got to track them down, and then get this, and then you go back and you bomb their homes and kill their families. You have to kill the families in order to wipe out that whole movement.
That's now, Robert. Wait, I hate to do Robert. I hate to do this, but I have to break for news. I hear you loud and clear on all these points. They're all excellent points.
Well, I just want to mention the Geneva Convention makes that a little bit illegal, but he just
yeah. There's that. There is that.
You know what I'm saying?
I do. Robert, thank you. Appreciate the call.
Okay.
Have a great day.
Oh,
all right, people are steamed up, and rightfully so. Right? What? Yeah, Wendy is agreeing.
She can't even speak.
She doesn't. She's so upset. She can't speak. We'll take a quick break. Steve will give the news, and then more of us, Bill and Wendy, WGN. Yeah, I'll remind them now. Thanks, Wendy. Later on, at 11:05, one of the presidential candidates will be joining us. His name is Zoltan Istvan. Maybe you've heard of Zoltan Istvan, maybe you have not. He will join us at 11:05 to talk about his candidacy and the idea of living forever. He's running on a platform that he has the secrets to immortality, and he can share them with us, and then we can live forever, which will be great. Eric Zorn will also join us. That happens at 11:35.
Is Zorn going to interview him, too? Because Zorn would be tough on him, I think.
I think Eric might ask him some hard-hitting questions.
Yeah.
I really do. So, we'll try to put that together. You just mentioned something in the news, Steve, that I always feel bad about, although I understand it, and that is the Jerry Kramer story.
Right.
Jerry Kramer, a former athlete, is selling his Super Bowl ring from Super Bowl I, right?
Yeah, the $125,000 he's selling the ring for.
And a jersey as well.
Jersey for $45,000, so that's, what, $170,000?
Yeah, yeah.
We used to, you know, when the Bears were on GN and Wayne Larrabee was the play-by-play guy, every time we were up in Green Bay, we would all have to go stand at the place, I think about what the 2 yard line where Kramer threw the instrumental block in the ice.
Yeah.
All those years ago, and he sold it over the weekend, and he says he's trying to create a college fund for his grandkids.
This just shows that this guy is a stand up individual who loves his grandkids, because you have to know that the intrinsic value on something like that, on a ring of winning the Super Bowl and a jersey that you wore for the Super Bowl, that just must mean so much to him to go into an office or walk down a hallway and see those things every
right.
day. And then you think, but it's certainly more important for your grandkids to go to college. But that's a tough call, isn't it?
You know,
it?
It's funny because I've had a few reactions to it. My first was, oh, this is sad.
Yeah.
You know, oh, this shows that college, the cost is way out of whack.
Yep.
But on the other hand, it's like, well, this guy, you know, produced this out of nothing.
True.
You know, it's just a piece of cloth and a ring. And he can turn it around and make a real profit for his family in it. So there's something, you know, it's not like he's doing it out of, it's not like he's destitute.
Right, true.
You know, trying to get by, trying to pay bills.
Right.
He's like, I've got this commodity and I can get this for it. Why not do it?
And that's the trade-off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have anything like that? Is there anything you possess that you say to yourself, if I sold this, my kids would have a much easier path? I could use this money to start them in a business or put them through college. Do you have anything like that?
I briefly thought of selling one of my kids so that I could afford the other one.
What changed your mind on that?
I couldn't decide.
It's too hard.
It just was too hard.
It's way too hard.
I mean, not which one I like, but which would bring in more.
As you know, I collect toys. I have a couple rooms
yeah.
of toys. And there are, I have some items that are extremely valuable, and my daughters have asked me on occasion, if we ever needed to, point at the ones that we should sell that are the big money items, and I'm always reluctant to do that because they'll have me put to sleep.
Think of that, though. You're kind of in the Jerry Kramer situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Except the stuff I have, like it's not from a particular moment. Well, I guess that stuff is the
no, but it's important to you.
Very.
You really much you cherish it.
Yeah.
And you could sell it and pay for a big chunk of your kid's college or mine.
Right. Anybody's kids.
Right.
Years ago, I had a bout of kidney stones, and I had never had kidney stones before. And if you haven't had kidney stones, you have no idea the pain involved in a kidney stone attack. It's the worst. Mm. It's like a razor blade in your kidney. It's the worst. And the way it hit me is I was getting ready for work. I was at another station and I fell to the floor and I couldn't get up. It was that it just knocks you out. And one of my daughters, Reese, came in the room and saw that I was in distress. And she just kind of brushed my hair back and she said, "What's happening to you?" And I said, "I don't know what this is," because I'd never had kidney stones before. "I have no idea what this is, but it's bad." And she waited a minute and she said, "I'm curious. How long do we have to wait after you die before we sell your toy collection?"
Well, what I thought was weird when I was at your house and you've got the stones, Nuppo.
Yes.
On the shelf.
Yes, on display.
Right. I don't think you'll get anything for those.
No. Those are not worth what I had hoped, sadly. No, not at all. But I really, the Jerry Kramer thing reminds me of years ago. I was working at Channel 7. I was doing a television show at Channel 7 for a little bit, that 190 North show.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to know John Drury, longtime Chicago newsman.
Sure.
John Drury.
Very nice man.
Incredibly nice man. And he collected erector sets. He had an amazing collection of erector sets. And John got ill, and then toward the end there, he had his wife selling his erector sets. And it crushed me because I thought to myself, and he did okay financially too.
Sure,
I didn't know
right.
if it's he needed the money, but he realized, sadly, his days were kind of numbered and someone else would enjoy these. So it was time to pass them on to somebody. But just hearing about that, and I never got to talk to him about it. It would have been too hard for me to have that conversation with him. But I just thought there will come a time for all of us where we realize whatever we hold, even, I mean, it's nowhere near as important as the people you love. It's just little bits of your life, but they're important bits of your life. And at some point you have to part with them. And it's awful.
Yeah. Or it's really healthy. I mean, if he recognized it, he's like, you know, I'm not going to bring this with me.
Right.
Why not get something out of it now?
Yeah.
While my family can.
Yeah. That's true too.
I have my rock collection from when I was a kid.
How valuable is that?
My parents are downsizing. They're moving. So I got to bring it up north and, my wife won't let me put it up.
Oh, come on.
It's not fair, is it?
You can't put it in the newsroom? They wouldn't allow that in the newsroom?
I've got iron ore. I've got pyrite. I've got
porous and non-porous?
Porous and non-porous.
Oh, Steve.
Fool's gold, you know?
You got fool's gold?
Pyrite, yeah.
Not a bad collection.
It's very nice.
It's very, very nice.
Stones from around the world.
Oh, man. All right, let's do this. We got to take a break. If you want to jump in at any point during the show, please do. I will allow it. Wendy, you say, yeah, we're both in. Steve's in. 312-981-7200. You can call or text us at that number. More coming your way next. It's us, Bill and Wendy, WGN. So true, Wendy. So true. Hi, everybody. It's us. It's Bill F. and it's Wendy Snyder. We invite you at any point during the show to participate at 312-981-7200. You can call us. You can text us. It's up to you. Here's a text. This is from 815. Jerry Kramer is smart. I'm 69 years old. Intrinsic value decreases with age. If you're just joining us, Jerry Kramer is a former NFL football player, played in the first Super Bowl. He's decided to part ways with his ring, his Super Bowl ring from Super Bowl I, and from his jersey for the reason that he will then take the money and put it into a college education fund for his grandchildren. A selfless act.
Yeah, I like it. Why not?
I guess, yeah. It just must be hard. If you're his grandkids, you have to know, I'm sure they already knew, Grandpa loves you. He's parting with things that mean a lot to him for your benefit. So good for all parties involved. Now, this story, which is as sad can be, out of Kalamazoo, Michigan. I'm sure you're aware of this. An Uber driver is up on murder charges for killing six people. On Saturday, a terrible, terrible story. Steve, question number one, does Uber change their ways in any way, shape, or form? This is such a random thing. They can't in any way be held responsible for what went on, can they?
Well, I don't think so because it wasn't had it been an Uber customer, had Uber customers been the victims, it might be different. It's a weird thing, isn't it? Because when are you working for Uber and when are you not?
Right.
If you're driving around taking calls. Now, I don't know if you heard the earlier, there was a guy who said he was in the car with this guy earlier in the day.
Yeah.
And the Uber driver had taken a phone call and then began driving erratically, sideswiping cars, drove across a lawn, And I guess the guy bolted from the car and called police. And this was an hour before the shooting.
We have audio of one of... Now, for people who don't know what happened here is... I have to say allegedly. Allegedly, James Dalton, the suspect in all of this, went back and forth between killing people and still picking up people as part of his Uber duties. And we have a guy who was warned that there was a potential Uber killer out there. I'll let you hear the audio. And then joked with him as to whether or not he, James Dalton, was that guy. Here, listen to this audio.
These horrific crimes. Listen.
Ordered the Uber on the phone. Quick pickup. It was a dark colored HHR. And I kind of jokingly said to the driver, you're not the shooter, are you? And he gave me some sort of a no response, like he shook his head or he said no. And I said, are you sure? And he said, yeah, I'm not. I'm just tired.
All right. So think about that moment in retrospect. This guy, this Uber passenger, gets word that there's somebody out there killing people. They think it's somehow connected to Uber. So he just kiddingly says, as you might do in a situation like this, although it's a pretty dark joke on a day in a town where people have been killed, you're not that guy, right? I just heard this report about a kill, but that's not you, is it? So then think about the aftermath of this. Obviously, he survives to tell the tale, but then you look back and you think, this is obviously a very unstable human being,
yeah.
And he said the wrongest possible thing he could have said to him.
And survived.
That's incredible.
Well,
that's
Ryan incredible. Ryan is there today, and this guy is going to be in court this afternoon. So we'll probably hear a little bit more about what they're saying was behind all of it. But I thought it was interesting. The guy who was in the car with him earlier said that he was, he took a phone call.
Yeah.
And once he got off that phone call, he began behaving very erratically.
So obviously, it leads you to believe that there was some bit of news that was delivered to him by way of that phone call.
Sure.
Right. Boy, is that scary. It really is. It's so frightening. And we know about him is he does have a family, right? There was a wife and some kids involved, right, Steve? Is that
Bill,
do
I don't know too
sure?
much about that. I just haven't spent my time on that today.
All right. James Dalton, 45, taken into custody Sunday morning, will face first-degree murder charges during his arraignment. That's today, Monday. At least two people have come forward claiming that they were passengers in Dalton's Uber car during the alleged shooting spree. The passengers were not hurt, but recalled feeling uneasy during their rides. With something like this, I always wonder if something like this affects business for a day or for a week or for a month. Would you be reticent at all? I don't know if you're an Uber user. I've never been in one. One of my daughters uses one fairly frequently, but
You've never been in an Uber car?
No.
Never?
Nope.
Yeah, me either.
It hasn't. Oh, you haven't either.
No, it's weird, isn't it? I mean, I'm not in cabs either, I guess.
Yeah.
I use it all the time.
So Kevin, with that said, and what just went on in Kalamazoo, would you hold back at all if you needed one? Would you think back to what's just gone on in Michigan and think to yourself, it's not safe?
No.
It wouldn't affect you, would it?
No.
Because I always think that the company, when a company like Uber hears of something like this, they go, this is exactly what we don't need. This is the kind of PR that nobody wants. And all of a sudden, we're thrust right in the middle of it, even though they're not responsible at all. I guess it's almost similar to what Subway has gone through with Jared to some respect.
Yeah,
right?
And the thing about Uber, I mean, there's some accountability there. You know, they have all the driver's information, so and they track them with GPS. So,
right.
If anything were to happen, they would know where to find them.
But true, but that said, I guarantee you, if you go back and look at this guy's record, James Dalton's record, there's probably nothing at all to indicate that he could potentially snap.
But it's just one of those things, it can happen anywhere, anytime, really, unfortunately.
Right. Speaking of Subway and Jared, did you see his statement over the weekend? He maintains that he would like to spend less time in jail.
That's reasonable. I understand that that feeling.
You know who else made those claims? Everyone else who's been to jail.
Ever, yeah.
There's not a single person that's gone to jail that thought, this is the life. This is what I was hoping for.
A for effort there. I like that.
What judge would look at that and go, we're so sorry, Jared. We had no idea.
I never thought of that, Jared. All right, sure, yeah.
What do you want to do? 6 weeks, 10 weeks, 12? What do you want? We'll lessen your sentence. You just pick a number. I love when somebody who's obviously committed a crime gets to jail and just goes, this is not the country club that I thought this was going to be. I'm not sure I can do well in a situation like this.
Can I just not do this whole thing?
Is there some way we can just look the other way on this one, please? Is there some way we could do that? All right, here's some texts. Text number one from 630. Bill, would you avoid Juul if you heard that a cashier went bonkers? I would not. No, you know what? I would not. But I'd get this weird thing every time I went. Let's say that happened, not in Juul, in just some generic store. There's some store in your neighborhood and something horrible, something horrific has happened in there. I would feel weird about going into that store for either a while or forever. Every time I'd go in there, I'd go, oh, yeah, this is the place that thing happened. So in a way, it would affect me. I'm not an Uber user, so I don't know if there's that same mentality, because I know you get somebody different every time you call them. But I might be just a little reticent for a while to give them that call.
It's similar, like, after the Paris shootings happened, you know, I was at a concert that following weekend.
Yeah.
You know, in the back of my mind, that was there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's unfortunate.
How could that not be? It's almost like, this is sad, but it's true, houses where there's been a murder or a suicide and they have to disclose what's gone on in the house, it's kind of along those same veins. All right, let's do this. We need to take a break. Steve will give you the news, and then you're going to meet one of the presidential candidates, one that you may not have heard of before. Zoltan Istvan will join us. He's with the Transhumanist Party. He'll explain that to you in just a little bit. Stick around. A lot more with us, Bill and Wendy, WGN. Steve, thanks so much. Zoltan Istvan is a futurist, a philosopher, a journalist, author of the Transhumanist Wager. He also happens to be running for the office of the President of the United States for 2016, part of the Transhumanist Party. He joins us by way of phone right now. Zoltan, how are things? Everything good?
What do you mean?
Oh, say that again, Zoltan. We lost you for a second. Say that again.
I said, everything's going great. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Is running for president what you thought it would be? Does it live up to your expectations?
Well, you know, I'm a third party candidate, and it's tough. I got to say, and of course, I don't have much chance of winning. But you know, we're out to make a statement. We're out to spread a philosophy of using science to live much longer and to live much better. So in terms of exposure and in terms of kind of spreading what I'm trying to do, it's definitely worked very well.
All right. So go through that with me, if you wouldn't mind. The Transhumanist Party is what, essentially? What are the core beliefs and values of the Transhumanist Party?
Well, you know, transhumanism is just a word that means using science and technology to modify the human being and to make the human being better. So the Transhumanist Party supports any type of science and technology that would, you know, literally kind of remake what the human being is. That could be anything from bionic limbs to artificial hearts to even, you know, cranial implants that might stop Alzheimer's or epilepsy and things like of that nature.
All right. So these are things that I think all of us want. There's nobody in the United States, if not the world, that doesn't want to live longer and better. Why would there be any opposition to something like this?
Well, to be honest, you know, about 75% of America is religious. Mm-hmm. And one of the core tenets of transhumanism is we're trying to conquer death with science and technology. And frankly, a lot of experts think within 20 to 30 to 40 years through, you know, genetic engineering and stuff like that, we probably will be able to mostly be able to overcome biological aging and death. But that kind of crisscrosses with a lot of religious beliefs, because, you know, one of the main ideas of religion is that there's an afterlife if you behaved well on planet Earth. So, you know, that's kind of where a lot of the conflict with transhumanism and sort of the rest of the world comes up. So that's why I think a lot of people don't necessarily always support it.
Do you know who Norm Macdonald is, Zoltan?
I know just a little bit.
He's a comedian. He used to be on Saturday Night Live. Now he's on all the KFC commercials. He's the guy who plays Colonel Sanders. He does stand-up comedy, and he said that's what our doctors and our scientists should be working on. Not all the little things. Figure out a way to not die. That should be the focus. And I guess essentially that's what you're saying too, isn't it?
Well, I am, and I got to be honest, you know, in the last few years, this idea has really caught on. You know, it used to be science fiction, you can live forever or whatever. You know, most transhumanists don't speak about living forever. We speak about living to 150 or maybe 200. But the idea is that because of genetic engineering, because of 3D printing, because of robotic organs, you know, most people die because of organ failure, we have a very real chance of keeping human beings alive significantly longer than ever before. And frankly, if we can, if the human race can make it to the next 50 years, I'm pretty sure that virtually everyone on the planet will have access to this technology that will allow them to live as long as they want.
All right. Now, from a political standpoint, look at it this way. I've heard so many people say one of the reasons, one of the many reasons we're having financial struggles right now is that people are living longer and we have to support those people as they live longer. How do you address something like that?
Well, so, you know, we have a lot of different political philosophies in addition to science and technology, of course. And one of our core philosophies is we would like to implement a universal basic income, which essentially says that everybody, you know, in America would get some type of, you know, amount of money that would allow them to have the basics, food, shelter, those kinds of things. And the reason we say that is because we know that robots are literally going to be taking all the jobs over the next 15 and 20 years. So with the universal basic income would come also universal basic health care. We'd probably be able to get rid of Social Security because a universal basic income would cover that. We'd also be getting rid of welfare because a universal basic income would be covering that. So one of our core beliefs is to try to take care of everyone and give them this opportunity to have this really, you know, amazing health, especially in a world where it's going to be more and more difficult to keep a job because a piece of software or a robot will be able to do it a lot more cheaply.
When you say universal basic income, does that imply that everybody would make pretty much the exact same amount?
Well, it means that everyone would have a very core basic amount, such, you know, something like, I don't know, maybe 50, maybe the poverty line, maybe $15,000 or $20,000. But the idea is, on top of that, you could do whatever you wanted. It'd still be a totally normal capitalistic society. But I think the idea is, with so many, you know, let's be honest, there's, like, for example, 7.5 million truck drivers in America, and they're now already experimenting with driverless trucks. So that industry in 5 years could be completely decimated. So we need to make sure that people have a you know, some type of income, because they may not be able to be retrained in the future. There may be no more jobs to be retrained for. So everybody would at least get enough to kind of cover the basics, food, you know, be able to raise a family, shelter, and things like that. It's one of the cornerstones of our political philosophies, because it's not that we lean to left or to right or anything like that. It's really about the fact that robots and pieces of software, they just simply can do things much more efficiently, and companies are going to be upgrading to those kinds of things. And so we want to make sure that people are taken care of as a first priority.
Should we be afraid with everything you just said? When you say these things, robots are going to replace most of us, is that cause for us to be scared, do you think, or not?
Well, so, you know, at the Transhumanist Party, we also are hopefully cautious, and we also try to work on things like existential risk. And I would say one existential risk is that machines sort of take over. So I think as we go along this process of technology becoming smarter and smarter, we better be very careful that robots don't eventually replace us. And I think we can do that just by having careful lawmaking, certain mandates, and also a culture that embraces human beings surviving as opposed to robots thriving.
Zoltan, we're getting a bunch of texts. If you're just joining us, Zoltan Istvan is my guest. He is author of The Transhumanist Wager. He's running for the presidency, as a matter of fact, a third-party candidate with the Transhumanist Party. People want to know what the incentive is to work if all the basics are covered. That's from 815. What would be the impetus to go out and work if everything you have is coming to you anyway?
Well, I think that would, you know, that's something that everybody has to answer for themselves. And to be honest, I get asked this question all the time. Well, what do I do if I don't have to work? Well, I don't, you know, one of our policies is we'd like to make college entirely free. So if you want to go and do a third or a fourth PhD, it's something you could do. So I don't know, maybe people would sit on the beach in the Bahamas and play guitar, or maybe people would become artists, or maybe people just would, you know, sit at home and, you know, become a guitar player. It's really not up to me to decide, but what we're trying to make sure is, in the future, if robots are simply, you know, more efficient at most jobs, people should have the right to have a very good and healthy and long life.
You had me at Bahamas, Zoltan, I'll be honest with you. Can you stick around for a little bit? We've got a lot more questions for you. You're good time-wise?
I look forward to it.
Zoltan Istvan is here, futurist, philosopher, journalist, running for the presidency, as a matter of fact, with the Transhumanist Party. You can give us a call or a text at 312-981-7200. More after this. It's Bill F. and Wendy Snyder on WGN. Hey, hey, I'm gonna live forever. It's us. It's Bill F., and that's Wendy Snyder right over there. Our guest is Zoltan Istvan. Zoltan is a futurist. He's a philosopher. He's a journalist, the author of The Transhumanist Wager. Now he is running for the office of presidency for 2016. He is a presidential candidate. Zoltan, a lot of people, by way of text, have asked what separates your theories from socialism. Now, there was a time, and I'm sure you're aware of this, that that was a dirty word. If you were a socialist, that was a bad thing. But Bernie Sanders seems to have cleaned that up a little bit. It's not the worst thing in the world now to have socialistic values. But what separates your ideas from a socialist standpoint?
Well, and that's an excellent question, because I get, frankly, you know, some of the major things of a universal basic income are incredibly socialistic. That said, one has to understand that when you look out 20 or 30 years and you talk about robots and software and all these things taking jobs, you're talking about a very different type of economic environment than ever before. You know, I've gone on the record saying I'm not really certain that capitalism will survive the next 30 years. It's not really a question of whether we're, you know, embracing socialism. It's really a question of how can we do the greater good for the most amount of people and keep the world together, keep it so that people don't go out in the streets when they've lost their jobs and throw Molotov cocktails. So it's you know, it's not really necessarily we're embracing socialism. We're embracing a path that will keep America, as well as other countries, kind of on a trajectory of better health, you know, better prosperity, longer lifespans and things like that. And it just happens to be with robots taking all these jobs, socialism or a universal basic income is the idea that fits better. But to give you an idea, we also have plenty of other, like, kind of either right leaning or libertarian ideas that might not necessarily go with that. It's really, we try to make all our political decisions from science and technology. Every question the Transhumanist Party and that campaign answers comes from a science or a technological point of view.
Do you believe in the global warming or not?
We absolutely do believe in global warming. And, you know, our way to fix that, I would say we're very strong environmentalists at the Transhumanist Party. Our way to fix that would be to basically support mega engineering projects that would make the world more green. For example, you know, We have destroyed huge amounts of rainforest because we've been, growing cattle. And about a third of the arable land has been dedicated to growing cattle so everyone can have meat. But meatless meat, which is just coming around the corner, is a great way to save the environment. It's a great way to regrow the rainforest. It's a great way to use technology as a method to bring back, the planet to its pristine condition.
We've had a couple of people text in this. 217 is the best. Why would anyone want to live to be 150 or 200 years old? But if you're living healthy, that's another story. Why wouldn't you if you're living healthy, right?
Well, yeah, and I think one of the things a lot of people don't understand, we talk about living to 150, is we're very close to at least stopping aging and potentially reversing aging. And now when I say very close, I'd say we're 15 to 30 years away from starting to really have some success with this. We've already had some success in mice with reversing the inner organs of mice and essentially rejuvenating these organs. So it's very possible when we talk about living indefinitely, you're not going to be living indefinitely at 100 years old with a cane, you know, and barely able to move. You're going to be living indefinitely at whatever age you want to live, especially when you're kind of merging with machines using bionics. I mean, there's a very solid chance that bionic eyes and bionic arms will be better than biological eyes and biological arms in just 15 years. So when you talk about living indefinitely, don't see yourself as this old person.
Yeah.
See yourself as this kind of this amazing human being that's sort of like merged a little bit with machines and able to, you know, keep your youth and vibrancy all throughout your day and all throughout your life.
But when you hear, and I'm sure you're aware of this, I've read it from several sources, that the millennials right now, this is the first generation in the last 120 years where their life expectancy is less than the generation that preceded it. How do you explain something like that? That's bad news.
Well, I've actually not heard that that quote at all. Really, people's life expectancies would be less?
Yeah, not dramatically, just by a year or a year and a half, but still it's the first time. Life expectancy kept growing and growing over the last three or four generations, but now this one, the millennials, it's down about a year and a half.
You know, I have not read that, and I'd have to see the studies, but everything that I have read points to lifespans increasing. And if you just look at the J curve, from something like 1900s to 2000, we doubled. there's every reason to think that because of bionics, 3D printing of organs and stuff like that, we're also going to double our lifespans from now. I can't imagine that anyone that's a millennial right now is not going to live, have the possibility of living indefinitely. The kinds of things they're doing now with genetic therapy, the kinds of things they're doing with essentially bionic organs and stuff like that, this is going to make it so that death as we know it, unless you're like crushed in a terrible car accident, is something very different. We're going to be able to eliminate things. And then we have this whole nanotechnology revolution literally just about to happen where essentially you're going to have these little bots inside your bloodstream. And there's already all sorts of little things we're putting inside people. For example, I have a chip in my hand that are going to tell us when we have diseases way beforehand so we can kind of attack, like, say, a cancer, you know, right when it's starting, as opposed to getting it in this, you know, third or fourth stage when it's sort of too late.
Right.
I think, you know, I'd say we have the millennials. I would be very surprised if any millennials die unless it's something tragic.
We only have a minute or a minute and a half, Sultan, but I'm curious. You know, you have an uphill battle. You even said yourself you don't expect to win in your race for the, in the race for the presidency. What do you think of the other people, the front runners, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders? What do you make of them?
Well, you know, from the point of view of my campaign, what we're really interested in is who's going to be the best candidate for science and technology, because we are trying to live better. We are trying to live more healthy. You know, in this case, I think someone from the Democratic Party is going to be more conducive to the environment of science, though I think Trump will probably, you know, be also pro-science. I think, for example, Ted Cruz could have been really dangerous because what if he had done something like George W. Bush did and stopped stem cell funding for 7 years? Ted Cruz might stop genetic engineering, which could be the key to eliminating all disease in the human race. So, you know, for religious reasons. So the candidates that are kind of leading right now, they're probably going to be pretty good for science, I'd say.
So I got to be honest with you. I read the story. I read your story on Huffington Post, and I wasn't sure what to make of you. You make some very excellent points. You really do.
Well, thank you. And thank you so much for having me on your show. It's been great to talk to you.
Good luck with the rest of the run. What do you anticipate happening next? You said you don't expect to win this thing, but do you go through, do you pick a vice presidential candidate? Do you have speeches ready? What comes next for you?
Well, we have another national bus tour. We have a strange bus. We're driving around the country trying to promote transhumanism. And to be honest with you, what I'm really trying to do here is set myself up for a much more involved run in either 2020 or 2024. And I'll probably pick one of the bigger parties to run with.
Yeah.
In my case, it'll probably be with the Democrats. And so I'm going to look to do this again, but on a much better level. So I'm really just trying to lay the foundation here and sort of spread the movement and spread the message that, hey, science and technology is much more important than Social Security, much more important than warfare, much more important than military or even foreign policy. Our health, America's health, that's what I'm concerned about. So hopefully maybe in 4 or 8 years you'll hear from me again and I'll be doing a lot better.
Excellent. Sultan, thanks for spending time with us. Good luck with everything.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care. That's Sultan Istvan, futurist, philosopher, and journalist running for the presidency of the United States. We'll take a quick break. We'll get some news from Kim Gordon, and then Eric Zorn will join us. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN. Kim, thank you so much. It's us. It's Bill Leff over here, and, of course, Wendy Snyder right over there. Every Monday, Eric Zorn joins us, and he throws an adjective at us that he wants to be described by. Today, he is the jaunty Tribune columnist, Eric Zorn. Eric, number one, hello.
Hello, and hello, Wendy.
And how do you explain that jauntiness that you have?
It's just a general, when the weather gets better like it did over the weekend, it just makes me feel like I'm happy and jolly.
When we get a day or two like that, we need to be happy about it because they're few and far between. But don't you feel once the weather gets back cold again that you've been teased and it's not
cheating.
Fair?
Yeah, it does. It doesn't feel quite as good. You're right. I mean, you thought like it just felt like spring was here,
right,
on Saturday.
When in reality, we have to wait 3 or 4 more months until it's like that consistently. That just doesn't seem fair.
And then it'll last a couple of days, and then it'll be really grossly hot. So.
We talked a little bit at the top of the show, Wendy and I did, and of course Steve Bertrand and the listeners as well, about what went on over the weekend politically. Are we surprised anymore when Trump wins these things? I know at some point it's just going to be, oh, there's another state or two. Have we reached that plateau yet?
Well, the polls showed that he was going to win in South Carolina.
Yeah.
And there was always a thought like, well, maybe the polls are wrong this time, because they were a little bit off in Iowa. If you remember, Ted Cruz beat him, and there were some polls that had shown Cruz had gained and was close, and then at one point Cruz was ahead, but then Trump was supposed to win in Iowa and then didn't. So there's a thinking that maybe people were lying to pollsters, or that the support for Cruz and Rubio and some of the other candidates wasn't being adequately measured. That didn't really seem to prove to be the case in South Carolina. He got about the same percentage of the vote that the pollsters thought that he was going to get. And the nationwide polls so far are showing him still way out in front.
Yeah.
And everyone is talking about, well, okay, now Jeb Bush dropped out,
yeah,
of course, Saturday night. So there's a question of, well, okay, now where does his support go? And the thinking is that people who are inclined to vote for someone like Trump were not going to be voting for Jeb Bush was not their first. Trump wasn't their second choice. Okay, it was the thought, well, these are more establishment lane Republicans.
But they keep polling voters and saying this is your first choice. But if your candidate is gone, whose vote do you go to? And Trump even pointed out in his victory speech that he's going to get some of those votes. They'll be split.
He thinks so. And you know, you never know where voters are going to go. And I heard some these Republican establishment people are going on the air over the weekend and saying, well, yeah, Cruz is at 34%, something like that. But we think that that is his ceiling,
right,
not his floor, that he's not going to grow from that, that he has this core support, but that everybody else is still looking for somebody else. Now, I look at those numbers and I see you add up Cruz and Trump, and I consider that kind of the crazy wing of the Republican primary field,
yeah,
and they're over 50% now.
Yeah.
And I think if and when, say, Cruz drops out,
yeah,
I'm not sure that his supporters are natural Rubio supporters.
Right.
I think they might be are much more likely to be Trump supporters. And it was just one of the things that I think is really interesting about this primary. One of the things was that the exit polling that we saw that in South Carolina, CNN found 53% so they feel betrayed by the Republican Party. These are Republicans saying they feel betrayed.
Betrayed by the Republican Party. Because
why? But because they feel like the Republican Party gets their people elected,
yeah,
often espousing socially conservative norms, and then suddenly, you know, they do nothing really about abortion. They gay marriage comes and happens, and tax rates for the wealthy. I mean, the Republicans voters feel like that the party is basically on false pretenses gets elected.
It's empty
like,
promises.
We're going to, and of course, empty promises is both parties are
sure
totally guilty of that. But that this feeling of like, hey, you know, you keep telling me things are going to get better for me, and they're not getting better for me.
Yeah.
I think Democrats are feeling some of that same feeling, which is a lot of the party feels, well, hey, we elected Barack Obama 8 years ago, and we're not living in this paradise that we were kind of hoping we were going to live in, that, you know, we're not going to come together. Remember Obama's speech in 2004, we're not red states and blue states, we're the United States, and
right,
he's going to bring people together. And before him, George W. Bush, he's a uniter, not a divider. The politicians are always promising this, and they're unable to deliver it because we have a deeply divided country.
But so you can blame some of that, not all of that, but you can blame some of that on gridlock. And I don't know that I can't imagine a scenario where that gridlock will ever go away. That gridlock is there forever, isn't it?
Well, it comes and goes. It gets worse and better. Obviously, in the 70s and some in the 80s, there was a lot more cooperation between the parties in Washington, certainly. And you've seen it in Illinois as well. But when the parties go to their respective corners, and I don't think it's been this dramatic in a long time where you've got a candidate like Bernie Sanders, who is all the way on the left, making what I consider to be many of his absurd promises.
Yeah.
Promises that I like, but I think he just can't possibly deliver on them.
But they all are. I mean, you pick a guy or a girl who's not making absurd promises that are just as empty can be. And I know that we're all, as a nation, we're nodding and smiling and going, that would be nice,
well,
but...
Yeah, they all say that. Obviously, and that's you know, the art of politics, is you promise a lot. David Axelrod said something I thought was very telling the other day about Hillary Clinton's problem campaigning against Bernie Sanders is, he says, it's really hard to be the one who's trying to kill Santa Claus. and that's really the situation. I mean, Hillary Clinton, for all her faults that she may have, she is not really overpromising the way some of these other candidates are. She's not saying, hey, we're all going to get along. Everyone, that would be foolish coming from her. She knows better.
Yeah.
You know, the country's not going to all come together to link arms and fight our problems together. So, you know, you have this and so when you have a situation where the voters in their own party, the Republican voters, are so turned off by their own elected officials, you have a strong desire for an outsider candidate to come in. Cruz is seen as an outsider because everybody hates him,
mm-hmm,
in Washington. The Republican establishment kind of hates him, and certainly everybody in the Senate hates,
mm-hmm,
him. And so when you have that appetite, those people are not necessarily going to say, oh, well, now we're going to go with Marco Rubio, or now we're going to go with John Kasich. That's not where those voters are going to go. So people are, the question that on everybody's mind now is Trump unstoppable at this point?
When one of the candidates gets what they consider to be a major endorsement, and a good example of this would be Marco Rubio gets the endorsement of Nikki Haley,
right,
the governor who was named after two high school cheerleaders. That's my favorite governor name of all. When he gets an important somebody backing him the way he did with Nikki Haley, an incredibly popular governor.
Nikki Heather Haley.
She's now three high school cheerleaders. You would think that would translate to votes, and it just didn't. How did that not translate to votes?
Well, it was like the endorsements that Chris Christie got in New Hampshire. He was endorsed by the major newspaper there.
Yeah.
I think Kasich was endorsed by these endorsements are not meaning as much anymore.
But with Kasich, he did raise a bit from the endorsement, not enough, but a bit. But whose endorsement do you have to really make it matter?
Well, it's going
to
be interesting to see what happens in South Carolina with the Democrats. They're voting a week from Saturday, this coming Saturday, and
yeah.
Hillary Clinton got the endorsement of Jim Clyburn, who's the African American, esteemed African American congressman from down there, and his endorsement was highly sought after. And the question is going to be whether Hillary Clinton can hang on to that African American minority support that she considered to be her firewall.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, people are saying, if you need a firewall, that means there's a fire going on. you got some problems.
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of endorsements are really going to be interesting to see because so far they haven't proven to be that important. Trump has almost no endorsements. In fact, he's got like Howard Stern, I think.
Caller pointed out before, and we've talked about this before, he's got like white supremacist groups that are endorsing him and that sort of thing. And I don't know that that's great for business.
Well, but nothing is stopping. He's saying all these things that he's saying, and every time when he picks a fight with the Pope, you're thinking, okay, that's it. finally, my prediction is going to come true. He's gone too far this time.
Yeah,
nothing he says seems to go too far. I just want to also look at these exit polls. Republican voters in South Carolina, 3 in 4 of them broadly support a temporary ban on Muslims entering the U.S.
3 out of 4.
3 out of 4 of them. Also, 44% think that illegal immigrants, we should just deport them back to their home countries. And these are people who Donald Trump is really speaking to. And it speaks to this, a very, very strong viewpoint that isn't going to be mollified by someone who's in the center, who's John Kasich, who's hugging people at his rallies and talking about how we need to slow down. And even though that message resonates with me, and I think would resonate with a lot of people in the middle, the middle is not driving this on either side right now.
No.
So it's a fascinating turn of events, and we're all looking to see. First of all, on Tuesday, I think it is, in Nevada, is when the Republicans caucus there, I believe.
Yeah.
The calendar's all screwed because they're going.
I know, it flip-flops.
Nevada, South Carolina, both parties are choosing different days. And it's going to be interesting because Trump is probably going to hold on to that too.
Yeah.
And then we are all waiting for a week from tomorrow, March 1st, which is this the so-called SEC primary, the Super Tuesday primary, where a lot of southern states are going to be in play. It's going to be really interesting to see whether Trump can run the table, if he can, in which case it's over.
Yeah.
Or whether Rubio and Cruz can pick out their strongholds and hang on, fight another day. I don't know why Ben Carson is still in the race. I do know that Kasich is hanging on. He's waiting for Michigan. He's waiting for Ohio. He's the governor of Ohio, so he presumably will win that.
Yeah.
He'll probably be strong in Michigan. And it's March 15th is the primary in Illinois, and Kasich has institutional support here for whatever that might be worth. A lot of the Republican establishment, the organization here is behind
him. They like him.
So he may have a chance to, if he can hang on until the middle of March, he may have enough delegates to keep himself going, and then he's also going to have to. He's going to have money problems too.
Yeah,
so
that's an issue.
So all these things we're waiting to see. But certainly, anyone who's got their money on Trump, it's looking better.
Eric Zorn is here, the jaunty columnist for your Chicago Tribune.
I do want to know what Wendy has to say, but maybe after the break.
After the break, we'll get Wendy's opinions on this. Thanks, Eric, for reminding me. Stick around, and if you'd like to jump in, 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy, along with Eric Zorn on WGN. It's us. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder. Eric Zorn has joined us, and we're talking about what you would have to agree is the strangest political campaign, the strangest political fight of all time, this year's election. Has it ever been stranger in your eyes?
No, I don't think so. Wendy, before you jump in here, I do want to say that it's you know, what we've seen is with this polarization, I think, is new. If you remember in previous years, the Republican Party has tended to go back toward the middle. McCain,
yeah.
Bush, both Bushes,
yeah.
McCain, Romney, they're all mainstream establishment Republicans. And ultimately, you know, the people like, who is it, I'm blanking on his name now, the 999, Herman Cain.
Yeah.
You know, people like that who they've pop up in the polls and then they go down. It's,
yeah.
it's kind of a ritual of the primary season. People go, oh my goodness, look at this. The party's been taken over by Herman Cain. And, not really. That hasn't happened. People thought that we've been saying that all along, ever since last summer. We've been saying,
yeah.
oh, you know, isn't this funny? Donald Trump has come along and he's a reality TV star and people are saying they support him, but it's not going to last. And it has suddenly lasted. And that's, you know, the fact that he has lasted a long time is amazing. But the thing that is truly amazing is that the other candidates have been dragged over or were already there. I mean, Ted Cruz has always been a very hardcore conservative.
Yeah.
Marco Rubio, a more moderate voice generally, but he's been pulled far over to the left, to the right, I'm sorry. So you've got the three leading candidates now who I think are very close to being unelectably right wing in the country, given the way that the country is right now. So that if you get someone like Hillary Clinton, despite all her baggage, you may just find out that the country's going to go, well, you know, we can't have somebody who is that extreme. And Hillary Clinton is not extreme. I'm not going to say she's got her other issues. No question
right.
about that. But, you know, the rap on her right now within the Democratic Party is that she's too establishment, that she's too comfortable with Wall Street, that she's too moderate, that she's on trade, on immigration, all these other issues. She's too moderate. You know, there's certainly some heft to that argument, but if you generally American elections, political elections are sort of fought between the 40-yard lines.
Mm-hmm.
You've got no matter who any party nominates, going to get 40% of the popular vote.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Either side. So you're fighting over that 20% in the middle, and those people who are, you know, swing voters and so on in these swing states like Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida, and so on. And I just don't see these candidates who are far on the edges getting those kind of votes, which is why I've been cautioning about Bernie Sanders. I mean, as much as what he says may make you vibrate, it's it's the idea of someone like that getting those people in the middle is dicey. It's a tough thing. And if Bernie Sanders is lucky enough to run against Donald Trump, then I think he could probably win. But
there was a quintessential moment for Donald Trump over the weekend. He wins South Carolina and he comes out to make his speech, you know, to thank everybody, to wish those who ran against him, to say, you guys did a good job, but I'm the guy that won. And he said, he was talking about, and he goes back to this a lot, his wall that he's going to build between the United States and Mexico.
It's going to be a beautiful wall.
It's going to be a great wall.
The
Mexicans are going to pay for it. So he brings up the fact that the former president of Mexico said, guess what? We're not going to pay for it. Say that all you want. That's not going to happen. And then Trump said, and it's the most Trump-like moment that I remember. Guess what? Then that wall is going to be 10 feet higher. And everybody applauded. And I went, that's the energy that he runs on, is if you're going to screw with me, I'm going to try to make your life even more difficult.
Well, the new tack that you're hearing from Rubio, and I think to some extent from Cruz, is they want Trump to be much more specific about his plans.
Yeah.
I mean, his tax plans are nutty and his health care plan is very vague.
Yeah.
And you know, all the things that he says, it's basically a lot of bumper stickers. And their tack now is that we're going to demand that he be specific about these things. And I think that is a completely fruitless demand, right?
Because he won't be.
He won't be, and the voters won't care.
Yeah.
That he excites voters. Somebody's saying, like, you know, he speaks his mind. He just says what he's thinking. And someone said on Twitter, they said, yeah, that's what my four-year-old does that. My four-year-old speaks his mind. He's not qualified to be president. So that's, you know, that's really where you are here. You've got these candidates who think, like, we're going to believe that the old rules are going to suddenly apply again. The rules that haven't applied since last summer are going to suddenly apply. The voters are going to go, well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
We can't have somebody who just shoots his mouth off. We can't have somebody who doesn't have specific, you know, 15-point policy plans.
Right.
I mean, Jeb Bush had the most robust policy plans.
Didn't do him any good.
Of any of those candidates.
Didn't matter.
And he spent the most money. So, you know, the rules about money seem to be going out the window. He spent more money in all three, Jeb Bush, in all three of those early states. So.
Well, you see those numbers of what he spent per voter, per state, and you get sick to your stomach because you say that money could have gone to so many better things.
And evidently that money is going to be going toward now an effort to stop Trump, that the party's coalescing again around this idea that we can stop Trump. But I don't know what message. Like, you can't say, tell us about your, how are you going to pay for that wall?
Yeah.
That's not a question that's going to throw him off his game. So
he doesn't, all he says is Mexico pays for it. You don't have to worry about it. And it's 10 feet higher.
No, but, you know, since Steve just walked in, we'll get to Wendy in a second. But
right.
Steve, we'll be talking about this probably on the Mincing Rascals podcast on Friday. Right?
Absolutely.
It'll come up, I would imagine.
It's the best Bill podcast. Subscribe. Wendy subscribes. She's always talking about it.
Just mentioned earlier today, as a matter of fact. Eric, great to see you. Have a great rest of the week. We'll talk to you a week from today, and we'll find out what Steve has on the Wintrust Business Lunch in just a little bit. It's us. It's Bill, and that's Wendy on WGN. Kim, thanks. It's us. It's Bill and Wendy. We have both of us have
now?
Been here all day. We have been here for the whole show, of course.
Bless you, Dolly. I just want to say that.
Dolly has a little bit of a cold, Wendy, and
I was going to say God bless you to Dolly.
She was up all weekend with a cold. She'll be fine. There's nothing to worry about with Dolly.
You kind of sound like you have a little throat.
No, this is the healthiest I've ever been.
Well, your voice is getting sexier. Did
I'm
you
I'm on
the
healthy trinity
the
now. No, that's not going to happen anytime soon. Thanks for suggesting that. Many people have wondered. We talked about this a little bit at the end of last week. One of your sons was in a play at school, and you went to every performance.
Mm-hmm.
You've now seen the show 4 times, Legally Blonde.
3.5. I had to leave at intermission for the matinee on Sunday because there was a potluck, and I didn't really want to participate, but I checked the email, and no one was bringing a salad. So I left during the intermission, put together the prettiest salad on earth, and my younger son and Jim say to me, how come that salad's so pretty and colorful? And I said, because people will judge me if it's not.
True.
How come you don't make one like that for us? Because you won't judge me. Or you do all the time. I don't know which it is.
Somewhere in the middle, probably. All right. Now, you were telling me this, and I think this is a magnificent thing. There was a certain part of the play that got an amazing amount of response from the people watching the play. And I think, as you told me this, and I already told you this, I think this shows that we are progressing as a society. Please explain.
All right. I have never seen the movie Legally Blonde with Reese
Witherspoon.
You have?
A couple of times, yeah.
Is there any singing in it?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't remember there being any
singing. All right, because it's not a musical, but they took the movie and turned it into a musical.
Right.
And there was a lovely little number called Gay or European.
Yeah.
Is that mentioned in the movie at all?
Kim, do you remember that being a part of it? I don't remember that. No.
I don't remember that either.
Well, there's the little pool boy, and he's wearing like a psychedelic silky shirt and pointy-toed shoes and colorful pants. And they were trying to figure out if he was gay
or
European.
Sure.
So a little trial ensues, and it turns out he's gay and European. Spoiler alert.
All right.
And so his lover stands up in the courtroom scene, and they fess up that they're gay and they're happy, and they dance together and they kiss, and then the curtain closes and they continue to dance and they kiss again.
Yeah.
And they got the biggest applause of anyone in the entire play.
How about that?
It was so funny. It was so great. And no one looked the other way. Everybody just said, oh my God, that's great.
Do you think if we went back in time 25 or 30 years ago and we were in a school production and that was part of it, that it would have met with anywhere near that sort of response?
I don't know. I think people would have just like been shocked. Did those two boys just kiss?
Right. It would have been shock. And I bet there would have been parents that may have come by the office later on and said, look, I'm not sure I'm comfortable with some of the scenes in this show.
I didn't even think about that.
That would have happened. There would have been a hard time casting two kids in those parts that would have been okay to do that. Kids would have gone, I'm not doing that. My parents are going to come. All the kids are going to come. They're going to see that. I can't do that. All that would have happened 25 or 30 years ago.
You're right.
And it didn't happen at all. Everybody, you saw it 4 times. Everybody was fine with it all 4 times. They loved it. They enjoyed it.
There was a lesbian in the scene, in the play as well.
Well, that they shouldn't have. That's where we draw the line.
And there was a sexy moment where Elle, the girl who performed Elle, who I just can't believe how great these high school kids are. I mean, I'm telling you, this was way above high school level. Even the set Well, I mean, I can't tell you how great it was.
And it's always, or usually, is high school kids building the sets, too.
Yeah.
So they show an amazing amount of prowess in all directions.
It's like a big square thing on wheels that they turn to for various different scenes.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was just blown away. I swear I thought I was on Broadway. And Michael did great in his role. But the lesbian, there was one point where the girl who played Elle did a sexy move, and one of the guys said, could you do that again? And the lesbian character stood up and said, yeah, could you do that again?
Oh.
And it was awesome. I mean, laughter, it was just unbelievable.
I'm happy you enjoyed it. I'm glad that it went off without a hitch. I just marvel at the fact that now, finally, something like that can happen, and everybody isn't just up in arms going, this is going to ruin society. You had two gay characters or three gay characters in a play, in a high school play. This is the beginning of the end. It means we are moving forward somehow.
Well, see, I haven't seen a lot of plays. Your girls are older than mine.
Yeah.
And so this is the first time I've seen it in a play, but I'm sure it isn't the first time it's happened in a high school play.
Probably not, but I remember when I was in school, they had to go through every play that would potentially be done just in case there was an accidental scene like the one you just described, because everybody knew if you put a show on and there was even one scene with something like that, there'd be hell to pay. You can't
really?
Show that. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. All right, David. I thought this was fantastic. What does this relate to you at all?
It does. First of all, it is fantastic. Congratulations. It's I'm old like you guys. I graduated high school in the 80s.
What?
Like Bill.
Okay.
Yeah, like
Bill.
Me.
Very old like Bill. Yeah. And I was the tallest kid in Highland Park High School. And in 1983, I decided not to play basketball and tried out for a play where they cast me as the lone gay character. And it wasn't subtle gay. It was, you know, pink dance pants at the time and my hair all teased out and lifting and kissing other boys. And I thought for sure that I was going to get beaten on by my former teammates on the basketball team. And the first night the play opened up and we were in a kind of a freeze while the characters were talking, and I looked out and a guy who was giving me the hardest time about not playing basketball gave me the thumbs up, and the student body really they took to it, which was kind of shocking for the 80s. So I think it's it's always been there. It's not as prevalent now, but I mean, kids are a lot more open-minded, but it was one of those moments where I thought, okay, cool, and I stopped playing basketball because I'm no good anyway.
Well, it has really changed a lot, because there are kids in high school where my son will say, oh, yeah, this guy's a girl but identifies as this, and mm-hmm. this guy's gay. And, I mean, he says it just matter-of-factly, mm-hmm. and they have such an understanding of it. But I never thought about parents writing a note saying, or complaining to the school saying, oh, you know, I brought my young, because they're during the Sunday matinee.
Yeah.
Oh my God, there were so many little kids there. I loved it.
There was a play they did in my high school. I want to say a view from the bridge or something like that. And there was a kissing scene with a guy and a girl, and there were parents going, oh, that's inappropriate for high school play, for there to be that kind of kissing. And it wasn't anything.
It wasn't like sucking face.
No.
It was smashing
just,
lips together was, to act like
yeah,
it was a long
two
kiss.
Two characters needed to kiss each other, or wanted to kiss each other, and they did. And you could just see a couple of parents like, oh, I can't sit through this. This isn't good.
Well, David, I'm glad you did that. Have you continued acting?
Oh, no, I wasn't very good, you know, but it was fun. I did it for a girl, actually. She got me to try out for the play, and then she broke up with me.
Oh,
so,
no.
Still bitter.
That doesn't play out the way it should have.
Is there ever...
I know, right?
When you go back to, like, your kids' high schools or whatever, do you think... Because I think back to when I was in high school, there wasn't a radio station there. I wish there was.
Yeah.
There was a TV station, but they basically just did, like, a news program. But I wish now... If I could go back in time, I would have totally been in the theater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure, why not?
You know, it's come a long way. It helps you in every aspect of your life.
Yeah.
It really does.
No question. David, drop off a resume, and if we hear of any plays in the area, we will contact you.
I will have my people call your people.
Please
Thanks,
do.
Guys.
Thanks, David.
And
have
if
a good
there's a,
go on.
If there's a play involving a basketball player, could you pretend or act like you're a basketball player still?
As long as he doesn't have to go to his left.
That's easy. Thanks so much. Bye, David.
Take care, guys.
How about that in the 80s?
Yeah.
That one surprises
me.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
We have to take some phone calls, but we have to take a break. Can we do that?
Yeah. 312-981-7200 if you want to weigh in on this. Call or text us. More in a moment. Bill and Wendy, WGN.
All right. We were talking about Legally Blonde and a scene in the LT High School's version of it where two guys kissed. And it was great, and it got great applause. There was a lesbian in a scene, one of the main characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's fantastic. You had said something like, would that have happened years ago?
I don't think it would have 25 or 30 years ago. I'd have a hard time. And I did some plays, and I went to see some plays, and I just remember people being very careful about stuff like that. Most schools would have shied away from anything controversial and wouldn't have had a scene or a play like that.
815 says, when we were kids, the scene would have been cut. Not saying it would have been right, but it would have been cut.
Yeah.
Kids are very accepting of this. It's the adults that have a problem. Because you mentioned something like parents, and especially the matinee show, where young kids went and saw it, and still, biggest applause of the show was
right
there. And it's funny, because parents back in the day would have complained.
So what do you think people were applauding for when that happened?
Because they were great actors, and it was a funny scene, and yeah, they were applauding because I just think that they were acting. It was a funny scene.
Do you think they were maybe applauding? Because I'm trying to put myself there. I wasn't there, obviously, but I think maybe they were applauding for the bravery of the actors.
Could
and
be.
For the fact that you could do this in a play now, and people aren't going to go, uh-oh, it's the end of civilization. You got two male guys, they're kissing each other in a play. This is the end of the world as we know it. Maybe all that played into it, too.
You could be right there. Because, you know, then at the end of the curtain call, when those two came up again,
people
huge
loved them.
Round of applause.
Sure.
It was great. 773 says, you're making me miss the North. I live in Middle Tennessee, and that would not have gotten applause. Last spring, I went to a fair, and the Beekman boys were there signing books. Who are
the Beekman boys? I just looked up because I didn't know who they were either. They're reality television show stars. They have a farm on a show called The Fabulous Beekman Boys, but they're only called that because it's the Beekman farm. They're two guys that are a couple.
All right. Well, the woman in front of me said, quote, are they brothers? Without thinking, I said, no, they're partners. And the look on her face, she actually stepped out of line.
Oh, wow. So much for progress. I thought there was progress.
Well, that's Middle Tennessee, not upper or lower.
Okay, good.
Tom was in a play, or you know about somebody who was in a play in the 70s?
Well, I was in theater and the speech team through high school, but I was also in sports. And it was kind of weird because the theater group is really accepting of just about anybody, whether you're a jock or you're in theater or they're just a lot of fun. But the funny thing was that the people that you would think that you might have drawn a conclusion that were gay were not. And a couple of, you know, one of the guys from the football team actually turned out to be gay, and you wouldn't have not thought that at all.
Or came out as gay, yeah. You wouldn't have thought that.
No, but the group itself is a fantastic group to be affiliated with. It's a lot of fun. I've encouraged my kids to move forward with it because it's just a good group. The parties are better than the jock parties, too.
Oh, the whole cast went to B-dubs last night after they wrapped, and, you know, a lot of fun. Thank you, Tom.
There's a lot more ability. Like, not long ago, if you were one of the athletes, you probably weren't going to be in plays or the other way around. But that's not necessarily the case anymore. And it wasn't always 100% exclusive. There were a couple guys in my school that were able to pull off both. But now, like in my daughter's school, I remember they'd always say, one of the guys my daughter dated was he was on the baseball team, but he met her doing a play. So
I know, I love it. And there, you know, band people used to get a bad rap too when I was in high school. Not a bad rap, but you had your kids. Oh, you're in band. Oh, you're in theater. Oh,
right.
You're in the chess club.
Right.
Good or bad, it was different than the majority of the students.
Right.
And now there are kids that are in band and playing football or wrestling. A chess club member. Well, I don't know if they're actually wrestling.
Maybe. Possibly.
But it's also okay to be smart, too.
Yeah, the barriers that were once there for
all
those groups.
You didn't
want to
look that smart sometimes. Like, if you, seriously,
no,
I don't know if you did that, but, you know, if you had the right answer, you didn't want to raise your hand every time because people
would be pegged.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Or I've
yes,
heard
even
anyway.
I had right answers once in a while and held back. Hi, Richard.
Hey, good morning, guys, or good afternoon. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
You know, I got to say this before I make my point. I really wish I was on your show. Bill, you and I are so much alike regarding all the trivia from television.
Oh, excellent.
I was a latchkey kid from the time I was 7 years old, growing up in Inglewood High School. I watched about 9 hours of television a day from 1975 until I left.
I know that.
And I, to answer your question, there is no way that any of this would have been acceptable, to use your number, 25 years ago.
Yeah.
It was only 18 years ago that Will and Grace actually had trouble getting on the air, and the only reason that it was allowed to be on the air is because Jerry Seinfeld decided to end his show at the last minute, and NBC needed something to fill it in for the fall of 98. Now, that was 18 years ago, and think about it. Did you ever even see any homosexual character on Will and Grace ever kiss? Probably not till the final season when Taye Diggs was Will's boyfriend, long-term boyfriend. But beyond that,
I'd kiss him in a minute.
It wasn't accepted. It just was not accepted. And that's, you know, think about it, that was only 18 years ago. So progress is being made. Are they accepting of it in Middle Tennessee? Probably not. But, you know,
never will
we're
be
on the
it
right
seems.
Side of history, man. It's happening,
Richard.
It's
to
happening.
Your point, if you even look at Modern Family in the first few years of the show, the two gay characters on that show didn't kiss at all until I think season three, and Mitchell.
Yeah,
I think season three or four was the first time that happened, because the network even still then was saying, this might turn people off. We got to be very careful.
Right. So have a character who is gay, who's openly gay, and they're humorous. And there's depth to them, but don't have them show affection.
Right.
The affection that, say, a hetero person would show.
Yeah.
So, yeah, man.
That's pretty interesting. Richard, maybe someday we will have you on, and we'll do a little trivia, TV trivia with you and Bill.
That'd be fun.
I am the Martin Tupper. If you remember that character from Dream On.
Absolutely. Brian Benben.
Yes.
Show. Brian Benben. I was, literally, man, I was a latchkey kid. I grew up in Inglewood. I would, from the time I was in second grade, 1976, I would be at home for 7 hours and just watch television. So my head is filled with all this stuff, man. My friends say my head is filled with useless information.
I know it. I'm living
it. All right, can I just throw one in? Wasn't Brian Benben married to Madeline Stowe?
In real life, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
How about that?
Very good.
I want to play with you guys.
Thank you, Richard. We appreciate the call. Have a great week.
Slamming me. She wasn't on the show. I know she wasn't on the show, but that's a little trivia fact.
That's
for
a good thing to know. That's a fun thing to know. All right, let's do this.
Just trying to impress you.
It worked. It totally worked. We will take a break. Steve will give you the news, and then we have a lot more show coming your way. Stay here. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Brings you back.
I love the guitar riff there, but it's when the horns jump in that song just becomes three-dimensional, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, when I hear Chicago music, don't you always think of summer?
Always, yeah.
Every time I hear it. We were talking about the band Chicago being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
The remaining original members were supposed to hook up, get together, and there were some problems with Peter Cetera where they just couldn't come to an agreement on what songs to do. So Peter basically said, that's it, do it without me.
And it's sad because they should all be there together for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So it's unfortunate.
Absolutely. So we were talking about Chicago and talking about the original members, which brought us to one of the most phenomenal guitarists around, Terry Kath. And we found out about a documentary that Terry Kath's daughter has put together that hopefully is going to be released really soon. So Michelle Kath Sinclair on the line with us. Hi,
hey, Michelle.
Hi.
That's how we all were talking about the whole Chicago thing. Born and bred here, both Bill and I are from the suburbs. We've spent our whole life here. Chicago has meant so much to us. We were upset about Peter Cetera not getting involved, and then we started thinking back of your father, Terry, and what a great guitarist. And other people in the rock and roll business thought your dad was a pretty okay guitarist as well. Some legends, right?
Yep.
Like Hendrix, Eric Clapton. Your father was amazing. How old were you when he accidentally passed?
I was almost my second birthday.
That's so sad.
So you don't.
Quite young.
My guess is, Michelle, you have no memories of him personally, right? Only what you've been told?
Well, the funny thing is I actually do have some memories that I thought were just made up. And when I was young, I talked to my mom about them, and her face went white. And she said, I can't believe you remember that. You were a teeny baby in my arms. So, yeah, I have one really vivid memory of him, which is quite bizarre.
Can you share that with us?
Well, my grandparents, my dad's parents, owned a lodge in Wisconsin on Lake Placid, and it was the Katz family lodge. They had both, you know, my dad and his brother were pretty much raised there in the summertime, every summer riding, you know, learning to shoot things and boating and all this stuff. So
typical Wisconsin things.
Yeah. It was quite a big deal for my dad to go back there, so he would often take my mom back there. So when I was born, we went back there, of course, to visit the grandparents. And my memory is him driving the boat on the lake and him, like, kind of just watching him, seeing him riding the boat, hat on, everything, and him saying, we've got to turn around, you know, the dam is up ahead. And my mom was like, that's so true. I can't believe you remember that. You were in my arms like a little baby.
That's amazing. Yeah. Good for you.
Yeah. I love it.
And so when we were remembering Terry Kath, a tragic turn of events where he had a gun and he had been shooting guns when he was in Wisconsin. Nothing new for him to have a gun. And unfortunately, that's what took his life.
Yeah. I think... The thing for me in really the drive to make this film, I mean, there's three things, really. It's like, obviously, get to know my dad, who I never got to know, expose him a little bit more for the artist that I think he needs to get more recognition. But I had the idea to do it and not knowing how I was going to do it because I've never made a movie before. But I've had a couple of close people to me pass away from basically a, you know, substance abuse. And in both of these instances, my mom just looked at me and was like, this is exactly like when your father passed away. And then I would be sitting there at the memorial thinking, okay, I have to make this film now because there's all these people left behind in the wake of tragedy. And it all comes down to really substance abuse. I mean, to me, it's not really even about the gun.
Yeah.
It's about, you know, substance abuse. And I think that that is something that the whole band had to face afterwards. You know, they expressed in a way that, you know, they had to deal with their own demons as well after that.
And in your opinion, do you think this was suicide or really think it was he didn't think the gun was loaded?
Well, gosh, I could answer that. Or I can make you guys go see the movie.
Yes, wow. Do that. Her name is Michelle Kath Sinclair, daughter of Chicago guitarist, vocalist Terry Kath. And what is the documentary called?
The Terry Kath Experience.
Terry Kath Experience. And is there a Kickstarter or something going on?
Well, we did Kickstarter campaigns. I discovered Kickstarter when I was at my wit's end because I didn't know how I was going to start the movie. And so the film's been 100% funded by fans and friends of the family. And we are the only, we're pretty much almost done. So what I did launch actually yesterday was our kind of final effort to make sure we keep all the music that we want in the film for our music licensing. And over the years, I created a members lounge, which is for, you know, people that donate. I've done behind-the-scenes blog that I've written on over the past, I guess, 2-3 years. And it's just my whole journey and sharing pictures and photographs behind the scenes. And really, once this is done, we don't need donations anymore. So I'm closing the members lounge. This is the last 4 weeks to donate, but it's going to continue blogging over the next year because I'm going to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and we'll be premiering the film, and there's going to be all these exciting things that I'm still going to share with the members but this is the last 4 weeks to join. So, and all the money goes towards music licensing.
And basically, TK Members Lounge, you explained it in a nutshell, a place to kind of share their stories about your father, Terry Kath.
Yes. Yeah, you can comment on my as well, which is fun for me because I can have almost direct interaction with people because I post something and they're like, oh, you know, they'll write little things back and we can kind of talk that way.
Michelle, go on. I'm sorry.
I was going to say it's all through the website, terrykath.com.
Terrykath.com, Kath with a K.
Michelle, you were talking about the substance abuse, and it just seems like just rock and roll music and substance abuse go hand in hand. It doesn't have to be that way, but more times than not, it plays out that way. What do we do to change that?
Oh, man. I mean, I think that it's really difficult. I think I relate it to my children, right? So, you know, I look at my kids. It was the same for my, you know, she had a great loss with my dad, and she really was just, like, hard on me. I think it's hard to say because a lot of it comes from your family. Like, how do you grow up? And then the other side of it is what you're around. So what's going on around you? I mean, I think that's what everyone said is, like, you know, drugs are everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, then if you didn't do it, are you a cop or whatever?
Yeah.
So I think really, I mean, and that's why I was thinking of my main motivation was for the people around the people that are using, because we're the only, you know, once they decide to quit, it's really up to them. And just what's around them, what can they do that will, you know, obviously seeking help, but it's really up to the person. I think it's about the support system and the people around them finding help and ways to help them help themselves, I guess, in a way. I don't know. I live in Los Angeles. There's a lot of AA and meetings and
yeah.
Al-Anon and everything going on. And from what I understand, it's a constant day to day in the moment struggle, and you have to really want it. And yeah, I think it's about your support system and what you've got around you.
And it's interesting you said, you know, with your dad having some substance abuse issues, your mom was really hard on you. She just didn't want to see you go down that path. Was she pretty strict then?
Yeah. She was pretty strict, but, and you know, as a teenager, I had my own rebellion issues. But
absolutely.
I was pretty good with my mom because I understood. I understood where she was coming from because she had it was a great loss. And I think for her, and a lot of the guys, again, it was normal. It was almost a normal way of life until tragedy happens. And then you're like, oh, actually, this is not normal. This is not
okay. Absolutely. We're talking to Michelle Kath Sinclair. And, Kev, if we could try and call her back on a better phone, maybe. A couple of texts and questions. 312-981-7200, the number to call. Daughter of Chicago guitarist, and I don't mean Chicago local, I mean the band. Guitarist Terry Kath.
But not the band.
Right.
But the band Chicago.
That's not Robbie Robertson.
No, it's different.
Boy, it gets confusing.
Yeah.
The Terry Kath Experience, it's a documentary. We'll find out where and when we can see it. When we continue, 312-981-7200, Bill Left, Wendy Snyder, 720 WGN.
How beautiful is that? Even with your singing.
I know, I'm ruining it. Sorry, Michelle, I'm ruining it.
Michelle Kath Sinclair is our guest. She is the daughter of Chicago guitarist Terry Kath. She's directed and produced a documentary, The Terry Kath Experience, a documentary. Michelle, as you were growing up, we've established that you lost your dad when you were just 2 years old. So when you'd hear the band, when you'd hear Chicago on the radio or records or CDs, was that hard to listen to them, or did you feel like maybe you were kind of getting closer to him through his music?
Oh, no, definitely felt like I was getting closer. Oh, for sure. I loved listening to him as a kid. It was like a special thing. And the funny thing, too, is it always his songs always come on at like times where my mom and I will look at each other and go, oh,
hi.
Right. He's saying hello to you.
Yeah.
I totally get that. And I also understand while making this documentary, I'm sure you found out just how much your father meant to people. And Joe is on the line. And Joe, this is Michelle Kath Sinclair.
Hi, Michelle. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I just want to say that your father was not really known amongst the top guitar players like the Hendrix, Page, Cap, Clapton thing, because he wasn't really hyped as being a guitar hero. But I'm a guitar player, and as a musician, I must say, as a musicians, no. And we all rank him right up there with the best that ever played. Even though he didn't get the hype and didn't get the big name as being, you know, in that class, he's in that class. And Chicago, in many ways, stopped being a rock and roll band that unfortunate day.
That's really sweet, Joe.
Take care.
Thank you very much for saying that.
Thanks, Joe.
And that's true. I mean, how old was he when your father died?
He was 32.
Okay. Wow. He didn't even have a chance. He already shined in the music world and definitely locally and across the states. But seriously, 32 years old, he hadn't even peaked yet.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Larry has something he wants to share with you right now. Larry, this is Michelle Kath Sinclair making a documentary about her father, the Terry Kath Experience.
And this is such a cute little story. In 1973, just before Christmas, when I was kind of a goofy, geeky teenager, I moved up to Hayward, Wisconsin to help a friend open a couple of music stores on a kind of a shoestring budget. And it was just before Christmas. There were people in the store buying Mondovani records and sheet music for Love is Blue. And four guys walked in with long hair and kind of poorly dressed. And it was a terrible Hayward blizzard. And they said, "We'd like to buy a piano. Do you have pianos?" And I didn't think anything of it, so I handed them a piece of literature. They huddled in the corner for a minute. Then they came back and said, "We'll order this one." And they picked out a dark oak, churchy-looking particular piano that we happen to sell mostly to churches. But they wanted that one because it was going into his mother and father's lodge. It was Terry Kath, and I felt like 2 cents. Because I didn't recognize who they were. Of course, this was 1973, and here's Chicago standing in front of me on the first floor of the former Walker Hotel, which was a funny little Northwoods hotel in our little music store, which was about 12 by 12 feet. And I remember a few weeks later, we carried that piano up to the folks' house. There was really no sidewalks, and it had been snowing, of course, like it does in Hayward 9 months out of the year. And it was just kind of a cute little story. And to this day, I remember it. I'm 67 now, so it's quite a bit later. But I wish I had taken a picture of that check because it wasn't Terry.
That would have been cool.
Great story, Larry.
I'll never forget that. So.
Thank you so much, Larry. That's really sweet. Do you remember?
My grandma used to play piano with me. It was important to her, so I wonder if we would be playing on that piano.
Sure sounds like it.
Yep.
Did it look like a church piano?
I don't know where it went.
No, did it look like a church piano, like dark wood?
I can't remember.
Oh, that's so funny. And Michelle, just to show how unique your life is, your dad, as we've been saying, your dad is the great Terry Kath of Chicago fame, and then your stepdad is pretty famous as well, isn't he?
Yes.
Jack Bauer is your stepdad.
Yes, I have.
Some people will call him Kiefer Sutherland, but I know better. That's Jack Bauer, and he saves the country on a daily basis, that guy.
Yep.
Wow.
I actually have some Jack Bauer action figures to play with.
Calm down, Bill.
I'll be right over.
I'd be more interested in the Terry Kath action figures with a removable guitar.
Ooh.
Yeah, work on that, will you?
That's a good idea.
You could put, you know, the Kiefer Sutherland and Terry Kath right next to each other.
That's amazing. That's amazing. We're so glad that Chicago is being recognized by the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Michelle, because they so richly deserve it. I'm amazed it took this long, but they really are one of the most influential bands in history, and good for all parties involved.
Wish your dad was around to be part of that.
Yes. I think it's so great. It's very exciting.
Yep.
All right, and you're going to be there at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And how can we see the Terry Kath Experience, a documentary? When does it come out?
So we are working now on when and where will be the world premiere. I don't know yet,
but it will be sometime in 2016. I'm sure there'll be quite a few different premieres at various places. But as in terms of when, you'll have to just maybe go to the website and sign up to the newsletter and wait, because we're still waiting to find out exactly, too.
I'll tell you what, Michelle, when you find out, will you give us a call and we'll put you back on the air and we'll get a lot of people out there because your father had just a huge amount of fans.
Yes, of course. There will definitely be a Chicago premiere for sure.
Good.
Well, we can talk to you again when that happens. Really quickly, before we let you go, Tom wants to say something to you and I don't want to have him miss this opportunity. Tom, Michelle Sinclair.
Hi. I went to high school with Wally Parisader, who played the saxophone. And I sang in a barbershop quartet in high school. He asked me to sing the doo-wahs for a background group recording at Boulevard Recording Studios in Chicago. And it was for a band called Jimmy and the Gentlemen. And it was the whole band in Chicago was playing.
That's great.
So he's saying, Tom sang back up with your father. Pretty
yeah,
cool.
Way back.
There is, the funny thing is that was mentioned by Walt in the studio, Boulevard Studios, and I had spent a whole day online trying to find a picture of it.
Tom, do you have any pictures?
No, it's on Ontario and Ohio.
It's still there?
Well, the building is still there.
Is still there. The studio's gone.
It was a famous, you know, it's been a nightclub for years.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Like, famous. Well, but the building is still there, yes.
Well, cool, Tom. That's something that you can share with everyone, and you just did. We appreciate that so much. Her name is Michelle Kath Sinclair, daughter of Chicago guitarist Terry Kath. He will be remembered certainly in Chicago. We cannot wait to see the documentary. So please keep us posted.
I will.
Thank you so much, Michelle. Take care.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Hang on. We'll get your number, and we can call you back. I really want to see that so badly.
Oh, yeah. It'll be fun. It'll
Kiefer
be great.
Sutherland is her stepdad.
Is her stepdad. Yeah.
Some people get all the luck. You and I really wish we had different parents. And she had two cool ones. That sucks.
Yeah.
God.
Yeah.
Is there still time for us to get some different parents?
I was telling my dad, Jason Bourne, that just the other day, how unfortunate. Let's take a break. We've got news and then a lot more show coming your way next. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. Thank you, Steve. It's us. It's Bill and Wendy. From time to time, we like to present something of a public service, maybe something that might help you out down the road. Restaurants are very popular, Wendy. Have you ever been to a restaurant, an eatery, a food place?
Does it count if you eat inside of White Castle on the paper plate?
Yeah, that still
they don't
counts.
Give you the boxes, you know.
No, I know. Then it's nicer. It's much more legit. The food people over at MSN, this is their food and drink department, have put together things that you should not say at a restaurant for various reasons.
Like, look at that cockroach? Is that one of the things?
Not on the list, but I'm writing that in.
All
because
right.
Look at that cockroach is something you should not say at a restaurant. I will throw these at you, and then you say if you agree with them or not. Sometimes they may need a little explanation. Here's one, and I'm guilty of this one. Do this very often. Let the chef decide. Now, I usually say, a lot of times I'll ask a waiter or waitress. There'll be a couple of specials or some things on the menu, and I'm torn between two or three of them. And I'll just say, you know what? If you tell me they're both good, I trust you. You surprise me. You tell me whatever one you want, just bring that one.
What are you thinking?
I love doing that. I love doing that. I do that a lot.
That is the biggest risk ever in the world.
I did that Friday, Saturday.
And did it work?
Restaurant.
It usually works, right?
Yeah, if you can't decide, just say, you know, what would you recommend? And they usually give you the one with the best markup for them.
That's
well, that's what I mean.
That's true.
I had a very nice catfish. I would have never ordered catfish.
Whiskers on or off?
Off at this restaurant. And, you know, they said, you got to try it. It was a special. And it was delicious.
But I know what you're thinking is that it's such a gamble, but I pick two or three things that I would never pick. I would never just go out of the whole menu, just bring me whatever you think. It's always things that I would be interested in.
So you either anything they decide you'll like.
Yeah. I don't know if it's the catfish or I don't know if it's that. It just surprised me. Whichever of those two or three.
You actually say surprise me?
Yeah. Yeah, no, they say not to do that.
I would never do that.
Never let your chef decide, never let your waiter or waitress decide. But I've had really good success doing that.
Except if it's day-old catfish and they're trying to get rid of it.
Right. That's, all right, there's that.
Why do they say never? Because they're giving you, they really are giving you the markup item? Or
it says, we all know the feeling of looking at a restaurant menu and not knowing what to choose because everything sounds so mouthwateringly delicious. However, you are a grown-up and you need to start making decisions on your own.
That's so true.
Tell the server, if you tell the server, let the chef decide, that is not useful. The chef is too busy to spend time trying to guess which dish someone he's never met would enjoy eating that evening.
That's now, a good point.
I never say the chef. I just say to the server, it's up to you. But Steve's right. They're going to go, okay, one of those is $28 and one of them is $18.
I'm going to get, let's see, an $18 tip
here. Or we have a ton of catfish and not much of the prime rib, so give the guy catfish.
Or they're actually interested in growing a business and they know that this is what they do best.
I like to think that one.
Oh, you're so naive.
I do like to think that one. I can't remember that one ever backfiring on me. I'm really successful with that.
You know, I don't really, I have order envy every time I go out.
Is that true?
Every time. I make Jim get the same thing I get because I'm so worried he's going to get something that I don't like. And it's funny because he now does that with me. I don't even have to say get the same thing I do. We do because we're scared that the other one's going to be better. Even when I go out with my girlfriends, it's like I have to be the last one to order. I have to make sure everybody orders, and then I got to go, ooh.
Have people stopped inviting you out at all?
No. No? But I do. I have order envy. It's like, so maybe I should just tell the chef, just give me, here are three items.
Sure.
I'm going to start doing that.
And then you're not responsible for your decision, so you don't feel bad.
Exactly. Because I can't make a decision to save my ass.
Terry and I have been together nearly 30 years. You know that, right?
Yes.
So in all the times I've eaten in restaurants with her, and we're talking about hundreds of times.
Yeah, because you guys don't cook.
We don't cook.
This week, yeah.
We eat out, Steve, really, all the time.
Would you say over 350 times a year?
No.
I would.
No.
When is the last time you ate at home where something was prepared?
You know what? One night last week we did, but it was Kylie who made shrimp pasta. We're farming it out at this point. We're getting people to help us at this point.
Do you do it just to keep the pilot lit, you know, the light on? Or?
Right, just to make sure they don't annex our
to
kitchen.
See if it works.
Hey, our kitchen is now a Starbucks. What happened to our kitchen?
We'd like to be rezoned, please.
All right, without the kids there, you would not.
Yeah. Well, all right, so.
You grill, though, so I guess that is the
difference.
That counts.
In the summer, we grill all the time. But Terry always in a restaurant, orders one thing. And then as other people are ordering, you can see it on her face like, oh, what? I ordered something, but I don't want it.
That's why you go last, Terry.
That's why she should go last.
Because I do the same thing.
Yeah.
Because then it sounds so much better when someone else is getting it.
For a while, I would take her menu, like she would order, and I would calmly and peacefully take her menu away so she wouldn't keep browsing. But it just doesn't work. It doesn't work. It's so sad. All right, we've got others. These are things you really should not say in a restaurant. There's a bunch of them. If you have some, 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. It's Bill F. and it's Wendy Snyder. The people over at MSN, at foodculture@msn.com, have compiled some things that they say. If you're going to a restaurant, do yourself a favor. Don't say any of these things. You're asking for trouble. This is another one I'm extremely guilty of. It says, don't say this if you're in a restaurant. I know it's not on the menu, but could you just do this and then you change something that's already one of the established foods that's on the menu? I have done this many, many times. I only do it when it's appropriate.
When is it appropriate?
I'll tell you when it's appropriate. The restaurant isn't there anymore. And we've had the man who ran the restaurant, Stefani, is in here. Phil Stefani has been a guest with us on the show. When Stefani's used to be open, it was one of my favorite Italian restaurants. They used to make a thing called champagne chicken, which was chicken in a champagne sauce. It was outstanding. Then they took it off the menu. And I would say to the waiter, whatever waiter we'd have, if it's not too busy and if it's not too much of a hassle, is there any way I could get the champagne chicken? And nearly every time, they would come through for me. And there's a few restaurants like that where there used to be something they'd have and they'd switch it.
I think you're okay if it's a place that you have regularly visited enough to know that they used to have this item on the menu.
Right. Right. But I wouldn't go into a place that I had never been to
and just say, hey, I know this is a Mexican restaurant, but I would love egg foo young. Is there some way you can make egg foo young for me?
Oh, I would make never you egg foo young.
I wouldn't. Yeah, no. I wouldn't do. I don't want that sort of thing. I'm not paying
but
for that.
But don't you think if you're familiar with the place, then, and you can say, you know, hey, can you make penne regatta, which used to be on your menu. Oh, you used to come here then? Yeah, sure.
With Italian restaurants, more times than not, they've got six or seven or eight kinds of pasta in back, and it's not a huge imposition to swap one out for another.
We don't think so.
We don't think so.
If it is, maybe they'd say, sometimes the menu even says, if you don't see it, ask for it.
Right, right. I like a place like that. don't do this in a restaurant, Wendy. Don't refer to your waiter as garçon.
Who does that besides the Blues Brothers?
I don't think I've ever seen it, because it just seems too pretentious. You're trying too hard. You're being pretentious.
What if you're in France? Would you do it then?
No. I've brought
Steve
groups
says
to France.
No.
The
really?
They actually tell people, don't do that. No, it's bad form.
What do you say?
Waiter
it doesn't
guy.
Matter. They ignore you anyway.
S'il vous plaît.
Say something French. Right. Just say anything but garçon.
Fromage! When in doubt, whip out the cheese. That's what I say.
Pamplemousse.
There you go.
I say grapefruit when I'm in a restaurant.
Or when you panic.
Or when I panic, I say pamplemousse.
Hi, Vince.
Hey, guys. I got a couple for you. First
what are
of all,
they?
When the server comes up to you and says, hi, I'm Sue, I'll be your server, don't say, hi, I'm Vince, I'll be your customer.
My brother does that all the time.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you know what would be a better thing? A better thing to say, hi, please spit in my food. And then the other one I had for Wendy, you and Jimmy Mack, especially like Italian restaurants, don't order the same thing. Narrow it down to two things. This is what me and my girlfriend do. We narrow it down to two things, and then we order those things, and then we eat half the meal and then switch plates. And then that way you got them both.
That's good.
We do that, but then the problem is I don't like what I ordered, so I want his whole plate.
Wow.
That's fair.
Wow.
I know. I just can't make up my mind. I think Jim's just going to have to order for me.
Yeah.
But that's a great idea, Vince. I appreciate that.
All right, guys.
Thank you.
And we arrange it ahead of time. Sometimes it's like, you know, do you want to split the pasta and artichoke mm-hmm. and chicken parm?
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll each get half. If I know what I'm doing.
That can't miss. That's
no,
a
that's
good idea.
Good.
Don't try saying this in a restaurant, Wendy. Up at the front, don't go, oh, you must have lost my reservation. They can see through that. They've heard
I've never
that a
done
million
that.
Times.
Who would honestly do that and expect to get a table after that?
I've not done that.
I don't believe you.
I've not done that, but I have, when leaving a reservation, I have used the word doctor before my name.
And they look at you and say, look at this clown.
Doctor of what?
Of what clowning.
Are you right. Are you a clown doctor?
A clown.
I get out of a car, a small Volkswagen with eight of my friends. It's just the nine of us. Get us a table near the window. Don't say this at a restaurant, okay? This is not in your best interest. I'm sorry, could you repeat the specials just one more time for me, please? They're very busy people, the wait staff. They don't have time to go over them and over them and over them again. They just want to get your order and move on.
I disagree with that one.
Do you? How come?
Because I don't always get it the first time. You know, the waiter has said it 70 times tonight to
right.
70 different tables.
Right. And sometimes
and
he rolls
the first
through
time
it
I've
quickly.
Heard it. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what's weird? It's we want the kids to order by themselves.
Sure.
And they're old enough, 13 and 16. But, yeah. You know, Dylan's very quiet. So, you know, I'm like, speak up.
Yeah.
And then Michael, God love him. He can order fine. But then, you know, when it comes to the choices, would you like fries, baked potato, slaw, or a salad? He's like, he just looks at him and says, what are those choices again?
Oh.
Because yeah. He wasn't listening.
But he knew there'd be a moment of that. He knew there'd be a time where the food is laid out in front of him, right?
Can I just tell you how anal I am and
yeah.
why I'm getting acupuncture? Because
yeah.
I need stress relief terribly.
Yeah.
I now go online to the menu of a place to figure out in advance what I want.
Do you really?
What is
that?
Wrong with me?
And then you still have order envy.
I know. And I've had time to study. I study the menu.
Well, but they don't have their specials up, do they? On
I don't
online?
Ever get a special.
You got to get a special.
I hardly
special.
Ever get the special. But really, I go online now. If you check the history on my phone,
mm-hmm.
you will see restaurant menus. And it's like I still get there and
how long do you deliberate? How long would you look at a website's menu before you go to the restaurant? Like 5 minutes, 10 minutes? A few hours.
In between games of Candy Crush.
Okay, here's another one, though. The waiter gives you the specials.
Yeah.
Everything on the menu has a price next to it.
Yeah.
But they list the specials without the prices.
Right.
That bugs me.
That's why I don't order specials, frankly. Because
I know. Doesn't that bug you? I know,
you know
it's going to be expensive.
There's going to be more.
Not yeah. always, but still, let us know.
The special at the grocery store is the cheap stuff. It's on special.
I am using that, Bertrand.
Steve, please tell me you've never said that in a restaurant.
No. Right.
Oh, I love that. I'm using it online.
Just the next time you're in the fine restaurant, just say that. Just go, I'm curious, just a little curious about the word special.
$47 for a steak. What's special about that?
Right. And guys, market price. I mean, I know it changes so they can't put it in the menu. But I don't know.
That's the vaguest term. You couldn't
for
be more
vague.
You can't
afford it.
But like, well, this market will give you $23.
Which market? Because I go to Aldi, and it's $9 at Aldi. Say that next time it says market price and see what they say.
It's going to work at Joe's Stone Crab when you're going for the crab legs.
We'll be banned from every fine restaurant within a 10-mile radius of here.
Did you hear when I was talking to Frank Sennett earlier? There's a real movement toward high-top tables now.
Oh, yeah.
Inexpensive restaurants.
Yeah.
You mean the bar height?
Yeah.
I don't like those.
I love them.
Well, because you're tall.
Okay, you're short.
My legs fall asleep.
You guys need a table on a slant, so you're both happy.
We'll eat on a teeter-totter, Steve.
All right, let's do this. That's a good idea. Let's do this. We'll take a quick break. Steve with the news, and then more show coming your way next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Hold on! I'm going to get some... Raggots and some rolls and raisinizers.
Some roofies?
Yeah, if Bill Cosby were recording this song now, instead of 1968 or 69, he would have to change the lyrics a little.
A little bit. Bill Cosby in the news, and we have Rich Lankoff on the line with us to help us understand a little of this, because I thought now that his wife Camille could not... be deposed because she was his wife.
Mm-hmm.
But now it turns out that she is going to be deposed because she's his manager. Rich Lankoff on the line with us. You on vacation or something?
No, I'm in Tennessee, actually, seeing some clients, but always at the call for Bill and Wendy.
Thank you so much,
thank
Rich.
Thank you. So, yeah, a Massachusetts hotel, black curtains were hung to cordon off the wing where Bill Cosby's wife, Camille, was ordered to give a deposition in a defamation lawsuit filed by seven women who claim the comedian sexually assaulted them. Now, I know the fight's been going on where she felt as being his wife, I can't fill out a deposition. I can't do this. But since she was his manager, they're making her do it. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, exactly true. You know, there is a marital communications privilege that says that if you assert that privilege, a husband or wife can not be forced to testify for communications that were made during the marriage. So initially, Camille said that because I've been married to Bill for, 52 years, I think, the communications between us is subject to this privilege, and therefore I can't be forced to testify. The judge on Friday said that is true. That may be true, but the fact that she was also his business manager means that she is compelled to testify. And there was a motion, emergency motion, to stay that deposition, and she lost that today. So she was in fact deposed earlier today, or might still be going on.
What are the questions that would make sense to ask her, Rich, in a case like this? What knowledge are they trying to extract from her exactly?
Well, they're trying to find out the details of the business relationship. The plaintiffs in this case are, as you mentioned, the women who are suing Bill Cosby for defamation. They're saying that because he denied the charges that they filed against him, and because they're alleging that he made them out to look like liars. So if I was the attorney for the plaintiffs, I would want to find out some details from Camille about, you know, the details of these relationships first and foremost. What the plaintiffs are trying to assert is that Bill Cosby, you know, did in fact commit these acts against them. That's the heart of the case. And that his denial of those acts equates to defamation. So the attorneys for the plaintiffs will be asking Camille questions that ultimately will go to whether he did in fact commit these acts against these women.
Now, see, here, Bill and I were talking about this off the air because this deposition is for a civil case. Anything she says theoretically could be used in a criminal prosecution. But what wife slash manager is going to say anything negative about her husband? But if she lies, you can't lie in a deposition. So this is a terrible place to be in for her.
Sure. I mean, great question and great point, and one that we deal with every day. I mean, you are not supposed to lie during a deposition, of course. Like any court proceeding, you are under oath. So you're supposed to tell the truth under penalties of perjury. But, you know, I depose people every day who lie all the time. So you're right. There is a conundrum here for her, because if she tells the truth, then that not only will lead to civil liability in this defamation case, which means, you know, monetary damages, but maybe more significantly for Cosby, it might lead to criminal liability, because they can use that evidence in the criminal case. But you know what? People lie every day in depositions. You'd like to think that that's not true, but...
But what does that mean, Rich? They lie every day, but they're not supposed to, and they're held for perjury. What does that even mean? What kind of penalty do they get for lying?
Almost none. I mean, I hate to let you down and destroy your image of the legal system, but, you know, civil depositions are incredibly routine. I mean, we take, you know, on a given civil case, you take, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 depositions sometimes. And again, I'm not saying that everyone lies in a deposition. You know, a lot of people do take their oath seriously, but it is common in civil cases for people to, you know, maybe forget that they've taken an oath. And the penalty, yes, you can, you know, go after them for perjury, but it's very uncommon. In a criminal case, you know, I think the chances of successfully prosecuting someone for perjury are a little stronger. But in a civil case, in a routine deposition, you know, this is, even though it's gotten notoriety, it's a fairly routine deposition. People do lie frequently during those kind of situations.
The other thing that's obviously difficult, and we all know this already, but she's defending a guy that, yeah, she's been married to for decades, but once the accusations hit 50 plus, you know there's something going on there. So how uncomfortable must the Cosby household be right now? Is there any conversation between those two at all? Could there be any joy in their marriage after all this has gone on?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the big questions in the case. She's come out publicly and supported him, of course.
Yeah.
But remember, I mean, this is a woman who obviously has a huge financial stake in the outcome of this. You know, putting aside the personal dynamic between the two of them, if he loses this case, he's subject to a huge amount of monetary liability. And if he goes to jail in the criminal case, that's also going to affect her financially, of course. So, you know, putting aside the interpersonal relationship, which who knows what's really going on behind closed doors, she stands as his business manager and as his wife to lose a lot if the plaintiffs are successful.
It just, you know, I know money is brought up, but I can't imagine that money would be so important when these women were allegedly drugged and molested by the guy you're calling your husband. At some point, it's like, doesn't the truth have to come out?
You would hope.
Just to kind of clear your name.
Yeah.
You would hope. I mean, we've talked on your show before about this dynamic of spouses standing by their accused and, you know, the why they do that. Again, in this case, I think, you know, cynically maybe, but realistically, you could point to the financial component as a reason. But yeah, I mean, you would think if you're Camille Cosby at some point, just like Jared Fogle's wife did immediately, you'd think you would come out and say, I'm out of here. I don't want any part of this. I mean, Jared Fogle, the Subway guy, his wife divorced him. I mean, it wasn't even I'm leaving. It was a divorce.
Immediately.
You know, a couple days.
Yeah.
At some point, you know, if you're Camille Cosby, you also, I think, are concerned about your reputation and your legacy and what people think of you if you're standing by, you know, this, what all accounts to be, you know, all, it seems to be a criminal. You're standing by this criminal who's done despicable acts over the course of decades to women. So, yeah, if I was advising her, I would say maybe it's time to, you know, cut bait.
I can't believe somebody would just stand by their man in
a case like this.
In this amazingly huge case.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. Now, a good attorney or team of attorneys, Rich, when you're Bill Cosby and I hate to say it, but he is now of an advanced age, they could make this thing last and last and last if they wanted to, so that there's never a day served in jail, couldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, it could be. Although it seems like the prosecutor in the Pennsylvania case is fairly aggressive. I mean, the age of a defendant or of any party is always an issue. You could always move to expedite the trial because of the issue that you just raised. But yeah, I mean, Cosby is, you know, not a young man. He's not a very healthy man. It can drag on for, you know, a year or two.
How can he sleep at night? If, you know, I mean, I just don't get it.
Yeah.
I really don't. Are you watching the People versus OJ at all, Rich?
I am. I haven't watched the last episode, so I'm one behind. I'm two in. I thought we've covered it on Legal Face Off. I thought it started off strong. I think lately it's a little bit, I don't know, the acting is a little over the top. I think it's
what?
A little obvious.
What?
Yeah.
we mentioned that after the first one. I can't stand it, the acting wise, but I am so sucked into it, and now I totally believe Travolta is Shapiro. I mean, I've gotten
Travolta's
used to him.
It's all eyebrows for Travolta. I like a lot of the action. I don't love Gooding's portrayal, but from what I've seen, it's just mostly crying so far.
Yeah, he's too whiny and
yeah.
But it's weird to see the defense team that OJ has with Shapiro, and I won't give anything away, but, you know, spoiler alert, all these other people that come to defend him with Johnny Cochran. It's like he had a dream team.
Why isn't Cosby getting
somebody like that?
Well, I saw a few minutes of episode 3 with Dershowitz, and we've had Alan Dershowitz a bunch. He's like one of our go-to experts on Legal Face-Off. And next time we have him on, we're going to ask him how he feels about, I mean, talking about whiny, that the guy who portrays Dershowitz, at least the first time, I mean, just terribly whiny.
That's Evan Handler. His name's Evan Handler.
Oh, that's right.
He was on Sex in the City.
And he was
on Californication.
The Three Stooges movie. Wasn't he Larry Fine?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's how I remember.
Well, his portrayal of one of the Stooges is less over the top than his portrayal of Dershowitz.
Rich, also, you brought up Jared Fogle. Now, Jared Fogle said over the weekend that he thinks less jail time for him would be a good idea. Just because a prisoner thinks that doesn't make any kind of a bend in anything, does it? Every prisoner in the world thinks that they should have less jail time.
Yeah, I've yet to hear from a prisoner who thinks that, you know, more jail time would be appropriate. I mean, the one thing that always was in his favor was the fact that he paid that money in reparation like right away. It was really unusual for someone in his position to pay. It was within a day or two. But yeah, I don't imagine any judge or any jury for that matter would have any sympathy for him. What he did is obviously, you know, despicable. So despite what he thinks, I think the judge is probably going to throw the book at him.
Yeah. He also said he prefers Quiznos over Subway.
He said that?
No.
What's with that?
All right. Well, thanks for shedding some light on this, because Bill and I were talking about this, wondering if it does go to trial, how she could testify, but she technically could, Camille Cosby.
Yeah, she could, and she will at trial, and I'd be interested in seeing how the deposition goes today. I would imagine she's not going to be very forthcoming today, but we'll see what the reports are from her deposition.
Rich,
earlier today.
Very, very quickly, should it go to trial, whose benefit is it? Is it the defense's benefit? I'm trying to think of who comes out better if she does take the stand. Who's that better for?
You know, it depends on a lot of factors. I mean, we've talked on your show before about how juries look at celebrities. So if a jury looks at her and they look at her as either A, a celebrity, or B, you know, a wife who's had to endure, as Wendy just mentioned, you know, years and years of putting up with this guy, then they might have sympathy for her. On the other hand, if they think, you know, she was part of this, you know, scheme to do this to women and also profit from his fame, then, you know, I think they would look at her less favorably.
Yeah,
so
I guess.
Really hard to say, you know, what a jury would do. But I think, you know, I think most people think that they don't look very favorably at either of them in this case.
And a bunch of texters have brought up talking about Cosby. What about Bill and Hillary, and Hillary standing by her man, which I still am surprised she did. That's a whole other issue.
Yeah. Well, Rich, thank you very much.
You guys, just speaking of that really quickly, did you see the picture of Britney Spears meeting the Clintons a couple days ago in Vegas? Well, the body language was interesting. There was like it was Bill and Hillary on one side of the couch, and there's a huge space between them and Britney. Was almost as if she was like setting intentional boundaries between her and Bill Clinton. But
and his thought bubble said, "Oops, I did it again."
Exactly.
How you doing? Well, thank you so much, Rich. Have a great stay out there. All right, take care. It's our friend Rich Lankoff.
Legal Face Off.
Yeah, he's one of the hosts of Legal Face Off.
WGNplus.com. That's where you can find it.
All right, let's do this. Let's take a very fast break and come back and a little bit more show for you. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. I have nothing to say.
There's music.
There's usually music there, but there it is. There's the music you so richly desired.
I don't know if we have time to go into this, but can I read this text?
Yeah, please. Sure.
708. We were talking about Bill Cosby and Camille Cosby having to be deposed, and she's not going to say.
I don't think so either. I really don't.
And she had to have known with all these women, don't you think?
I can't imagine her not knowing that there were things going on that were awful, terrible. Yeah, I can't. And, you know, I brought this up with Rich, and I'll bring it up with you. At some point in your relationship, I'm sure there's been a day or two where things have been a little frosty between you and your husband, and it's hard to get around the house and address each other. And imagine what goes on in that house on a daily basis at this stage, right?
I couldn't be in that house.
No.
And then somebody had said, you know, a couple of texters, what about Bill and Hillary? And I can't believe Hillary just looked the other way on that when Bill had his little cigar party.
Is that what it was called?
Yes, it was. That's
party?
What I'm calling it.
All right.
708 says, denial is a powerful thing. Perhaps Mrs. Cosby believes her husband. You say you don't get it, but he's not your husband. People give husbands and families every benefit of the doubt, which is something I said to you off the air. Giving your husband the benefit of the doubt and your children the benefit of the doubt, to me, are two entirely different things.
Right.
If someone... I don't know. It's just a different thing. I feel like maybe with your children, you're trying to teach them. You're there to help them, depending on their age.
Right.
And you're their parent.
True.
You defend them. But a husband or wife, it's a whole different thing.
It is a different thing. It is. You know the vibe that must be given out? Let's say you're in a relationship and one member is cheating on the other. There's some sort of a vibe that you get that something's not quite right. I can't imagine the vibe she must have gotten from him countless times.
And
from
not
just cheating, but
right. Sexually
assaulting somebody.
That's it. It's one thing, you know, oh, my husband cheated on me. I can't even imagine what that would be like. But then to say my husband drugged people allegedly
right. And
took advantage of them.
Right.
He's a monster.
So many times over such a long span. So maybe she's got this built-in defense thing where at this point it's just secondary. You know, maybe the worst of it has already passed for her, or she thinks it has.
A couple of texts have some ideas of why she's able to deal with this.
One,
it's a really big house, so maybe she doesn't see him.
That could, honestly, that could play into it. It really could.
Or perhaps maybe she was drugged too. At this
Anything's
point,
possible.
I know. Isn't that terrible?
Anything is possible. Yeah.
Maybe she's not defending the affairs as much as the drugging, just pending the drug. I don't know what that means.
I'm not sure what they can get out of her that will help or hurt them at this point. I mean, they've got all these women. They've got 50 plus women that have come forward. And I know this case doesn't handle all 50. This is handling seven because of the statute of limitations. But
I don't know what she could possibly give them at this point that they haven't already heard. I know it's a different version of it because it's coming from her as opposed to them. But
even if they ask him, are you aware of any of the practices? Are you aware of any drugs that your husband had in the medicine cabinet that would? I mean, she's not going to say yes,
as Rich Lankoff
probably doesn't
just
know.
Said. You get a lot of lies in this. So their attorney is going to say to her, you don't know anything. You just go up there. You don't know anything.
And somebody took issue with the fact that Rich Lankoff was saying, unfortunately, a lot of people under deposition do lie. And someone said, 951, I don't doubt that people lie in depositions, but it seems kind of irresponsible to depict it as an everyday practice. I know that I would be too scared to lie under oath.
Yeah.
And I think a good many people feel that way.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm positive.
And if that's what I was shocked about. If you lie, if you're being deposed and nothing happens to you, why wouldn't everybody lie?
That's the game.
I'm with Stephen Avery, man. I'm going to get him out.
All right. Before tomorrow? Can you do it by tomorrow? We'll have him on with us tomorrow.
I would like to. We'll take a collect call.
All right. A break. We'll find out what Roe and Anna have coming your way next. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN.